The time is now 8:31 a.m. on December 10th, 2021, and I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. This meeting is video hosted using Zoom. The Republican parties on this agenda have been properly noticed of this fact and have been supplied with meeting access instructions. Ms. Poe, will you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Mr. Dinar?
Good morning, I'm present.
Dr. Malott? Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Mr. Wynn? We have a quorum.
Thank you. Please note that the times stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of one agenda item, proceed to a timed item, and then return to the former agenda item at a later time. The board may also reorder non-timed items. The board encourages everyone in attendance today to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You will find the link on the meeting agenda that is posted on the board's website. I want to take a moment to recognize all of the board members for your hard work. Every month, each board member spends many hours in preparation for this meeting. We do appreciate your time, your effort, your diligence in reviewing all of the documentation. And I'd also like to acknowledge the efforts of board staff and our attorney. And I will note that I at least feel every month that the board staff continues to explore efficiencies that make our life much easier. So thank you to board staff for their continued efforts there and for making sure that we have everything that we need to proceed with these meetings. We appreciate all of your time and hard work. Attendance of this board meeting is eligible for continuing education credit if it is at least 4 hours long. I would note that based on the current agenda, quorum, different variations, we likely may not go 4 hours. So if it does not go 4 hours today, it will not count as a continuing education. But should it go 4 hours or more, please make sure that you take note of the code words provided throughout the meeting. Board staff, for the purposes of earning continuing education credit, please look for a link on the board meetings page for this particular meeting. So we'll still proceed with the code words. However, it is possible that the meeting will not go the full 4 hours. We have recently learned that due to health issues, Dr. Gill elected to step down from the board. He composed a letter to the board members and staff, which is saved in our meeting documents folder, in which he extends his appreciation for having served time to protect the public with us. I know I speak for all of us when I say Dr. Gill's contributions to the public were significant, and he will be missed. Our former, I want to take a moment to see if anybody had any comments that they wanted to make. I don't know if Dr. Gill will be able to see them or hear them. Please be cautious of personally identifiable health information. Does any board members have any comments they would like to make?
Just Dr. Davis. Missed. Yeah, just to help you, he was a valuable member of this board for quite a period of time, and his expertise and demeanor will be missed by this group, I'm sure.
Thank you.
I will second those comments. Very detailed, and he's a psychologist. He added a lot to this board, and he will be missed.
Definitely.
So I hope we sent him a "we appreciate you" letter, or something that, something back and let him know that his time was well served and that we appreciated him.
Madam Chair, Ms. Creep, that's been articulated to him, but I'd be happy to follow up with something more formal. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would just add that Dr. Gill and I started at the same time on the board, and I have enjoyed working with him and will miss him.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Yes, he will be missed. I'm sure we will see him around. And I do know, I will add too, that board staff is working diligently to communicate with the governor's office on finding a psychologist replacement. All right.
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Poe. Just Ms. Poe. Roll call records. I did see Mr. Nguyen joined at 8:32, it looked like a.m.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Nguyen. All right. Our former executive director, Dr. Olvey, was recently reelected to serve as a second term as secretary treasurer of ASPPB. She submitted a letter to the board, also in your reading documents folder, in which she expresses her gratitude for having nominated her as a candidate. Congratulations to Dr. Olvey.
And can I just jump? Can I say something, Madam Chair? For those of you that worked with her, I've worked with her when she was executive director. She's phenomenal. And we are so lucky to have her representing us on a national board. Amazing, smart, articulate, knows her stuff, but very exciting. I'm very happy for her.
Thank you, Ms. Shreef. I agree. Anybody else have anything to add?
No, I knew her from when she was a student, and she's really gone far. Did yeah. very, very well and been a real asset to Arizona.
Absolutely. Thank you. We'll now move to the call to the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board will limit the number of persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any public comment matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. Pursuant to ARS 38-431.02H, the board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or with the other member of the public addressing the board. The only option available is to instruct staff to place a topic on future agenda if applicable. Those wishing to speak, please unmute your line, state your name, and I will call on you. Hearing none, we also had no prior request to speak, so we will go ahead and move forward. Council update, Ms. Galvin, do you have an update for the board?
I do not have an update at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. We will move to agenda item number 6, the consent agenda. For the record, are there any recusals from any items on the consent agenda? I have one, and that is going to be the behavior analyst application for number 3, Jade Fristam. A board member may request to remove an item from the consent agenda for independent discussion and action. Are there any such requests? I also have one, and that's going to be the meeting minutes for the November 5th meeting. We are still working to catch up on some of those meeting minutes, so they were not presented ahead of time. We will get those to you for the next meeting.
I did have a comment on the meeting minutes. In that it said absent, I was excused, I believe, because I mentioned that I was at a conference.
Perfect, thank you. All right, then do we have a motion to approve the items on the consent agenda?
So moved.
Ms. Diana.
I'll second then, Mr. Diana.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Want to listen to some of this?
Any okay. opposed?
I'm not even, I think it's.
Hearing none, the motion carries.
Madam Chair, we can go to number 7 for Dr. Briggs. We have both parties here.
Thank you. All right, agenda item number 7. Ms. Michelson, would you please provide a summary of this matter to the board?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Briggs has been licensed by this board since 1998 and currently maintains a private practice. In August of this year, the board received a complaint from MM, who is a psychology doctoral program student, who has placed at Dr. Briggs's practice for the 2020 through 2021 training year. MM alleged in her complaint that in April of 2021, she and a colleague entered into Dr. Briggs's office after knocking on his door and receiving permission to enter. Upon being invited in, they observed Dr. Briggs's computer monitor displaying a still image of a pornographic video. After consulting with her academic advisor at the school, MM reported that she requested to be removed from his training site as she considered it to be an unsafe environment. Upon receiving this complaint, Dr. Briggs retained legal counsel, and the attorney's associate, Mr. Beardsley, contacted board staff to discuss a possible settlement offer to the board. It was relayed to staff that Dr. Briggs acknowledged that the conduct occurred, although what occurred was not intentional, and that Dr. Briggs would consider entering into a consent agreement to surrender his license. However, he would need until August 1st of next year to complete the remaining reports for the evaluations that he has done, and that there were approximately 100 reports left to be written. Mr. Beardsley relayed that Dr. Briggs performed his last evaluation in September and has stopped accepting new patients, but would not be able to complete these reports until approximately August 1st of 2022. With the assistance of Ms. Galvin, a proposed consent agreement for surrender was drafted and sent to Dr. Briggs's attorney for review and consideration and included the following stipulations. Dr. Briggs's license shall be surrendered. However, the surrender is stayed, but becomes effective on August 1st of 2022. So to allow Dr. Briggs sufficient time to complete his outstanding reports. Between the effective date of the consent agreement and the date of the surrender, his practice is restricted in that he is prohibited from accepting any new patients or completing any new evals. During this time period, he may only complete the final written reports of evaluations already conducted. Any patients currently waiting or scheduled to be seen shall be referred to other psychologists. It also stipulates by December 17th of this month, Dr. Briggs shall submit to board staff a log listing the name of each patient for whom a report is outstanding. The log shall also indicate the date the evaluation was conducted and provide a space indicating the date that the report was completed. He shall submit an updated log to staff on the first day of each month through August 1st of next year. This consent agreement also stipulated that he shall not supervise any pre-internship or postdoctoral students. Board staff received the signed consent agreement from Dr. Briggs approximately 2 weeks ago, which is before the board for review and possible approval as a final disposition in this case. I do want to note that it is a disciplinary action that would be reported to the data bank. I do see that Mr. Beardsley and Dr. Briggs are present today. We do also have the complainant, MM, who is here as well, and I do believe she would like to make a brief statement, Madam Chair. That does conclude my summary, but please let me know if there are any questions.
Thank you. MM, if you would like to take a moment to unmute yourself, please only refer to yourself by your initials, and you are welcome to make a statement at this time.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Oh,
great. I just have a brief statement that I've written that I would like to share. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today and for the board's time in investigating this case. I feel my written statement has addressed most of the details of this event as well as the impact it has had on me personally, but I wanted to briefly describe the impact it has had on my clinical training this year. I'm currently on internship and I have found it difficult to trust the staff of my new site, not because they seem like inherently dishonest people, but because I feel I can no longer trust my own judgment of appropriate versus inappropriate supervisors. Through this experience, I have on some level learned that my initial gut sense of a supervisor's character may not be an accurate gauge, and even people around whom I feel comfortable may end up behaving in ways I never could have imagined. This has created a barrier in my being able to feel safe in my clinical environment, especially in supervision. I have found it difficult to build trust with my supervisor. I have found myself waiting for the other shoe to drop, as it were, anticipating the moment when the veneer wears off and I see the real dysfunction underneath. The most difficult aspect of this case is that I liked Dr. Briggs. I enjoyed being at his practice and I enjoyed interacting with him. The sense of utter confusion and betrayal I felt following this incident has followed me into my internship site. I genuinely enjoy working with my current supervisor, and I have had to and will continue to have to quiet the voice in the back of my mind that says not to trust this feeling of enjoyment and comfort. I continue to experience personal impacts, but as I said earlier, I feel I have more or less addressed those in my initial complaint narrative. What I have not anticipated was the impact this incident would have on my continued professional development. Thank you again for your time and attention.
Thank you, MM. So board members have any questions for MM at this time? Hearing none.
Yep. MM, from your experience, how many write-ups or reports were done per week? Do you have any idea? How many did you do, or whatever you can add to that?
So as a practicum student, I basically performed the function of a psychometrist, more or less. I wrote the behavioral observations and any summary of records that had been received for the evaluation. I did not write any of the clinical impressions or write up any of the results.
Did you have any knowledge, you know, of when, how long it might take for first from beginning to end, from the beginning an evaluation to the end, when the results were presented, to just how long it might, a write up might take once all the testing was done? Do you have any idea? Have you seen?
From my understanding, I think when I was working there, the turnaround time was anywhere from 6 to 9 months. We did approximately 3 evaluations per week, 3 comprehensive neuropsychological evaluations per week, with some on Saturdays. And I know that the wait list was pretty far booked out. Beyond that, I'm not sure what the back end process was.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any additional questions? Hearing none, we do have Dr. Briggs and his attorney, Mr. Beardsley, with us. If you could both unmute your mics and introduce yourselves, and then you guys are welcome to make a statement if you would like at this time.
Morning to the board members. We appreciate your consideration of this consent agreement. My name is Robert Beardsley. I'm here on behalf of Dr. Briggs. I only want to make a brief statement just to correct one fact that I think bears noting in Ms. Michelson's rendition of the complaint. I think that it was alleged that both students, both MM and the other student that entered into the room with her, viewed this pornographic material. It was my understanding that only MM viewed this, was able to reach a vantage point in the room where she could see this material. I think that bears noting because it tends to corroborate what Dr. Briggs has said, that this was unintentional. This wasn't an intentional exposure. All that being said, he appreciates the board's consideration of this consent agreement. He is here to take responsibility for his unprofessional conduct. He appreciates that this is not material that he should have been viewing. Regardless of whether the door was closed, it was his lunch break, he appreciates that this is not material for the workplace, and he is apologetic to both this board and the complainant. If Dr. Briggs wishes to address the board, he may now.
Yes, good morning. My name is Bob Briggs. Excuse me. I am very sad about what happened. MM was a good student. I did not intend to do any harm. I feel ashamed of what I've done, and under advice of counsel and also my own thoughts, I've stopped seeing people since last September. Well, 3 months ago, September. Because there are only a few of us that do evaluations for the population I work with, which is typically access families, I'm requesting the time to finish the reports that I have. Literally these days, I am alone in my office doing reports. So I would appreciate whatever consideration the board would have me with that, because I would like to finish the reports and finish. I've enjoyed my responsibilities as a psychologist. I've been doing this for a long time, from value option days, from neuropsych. And I just did a very unconscionable, stupid thing on my part. But again, it didn't affect my ability to supervise, but it certainly was something that I'm ashamed of doing. And I hated to see the response.
Thank you, Dr. Briggs. Board members, do you have any questions for Dr. Briggs?
I just have one, you know, maybe I'm jaded by the school district, but evaluations usually have to be completed within 60 days from the beginning of the testing to the complete write-up. So it just seems so long, 8 to 9 months, and, you know, the public would be waiting for these reports. You really don't feel you could get anything done sooner?
I agree, Dr. Caterino, I'm sorry. What I've done in those cases is be able to generate, a preliminary report of findings that address school concerns for IEPs, for instance.
Right.
So I can generate that. The questions that come to me are typically involved with DDD services or other kinds of things that require more information and typically more collateral information. What I always look for family members or outside family members to provide for me information. And part of the frustration has been sometimes that is forthcoming, sometimes it is not forthcoming. Mm-hmm. And so I'm left basically with a lot of the report written, with the exception of some key elements that I don't have yet. So requests are made, and that's why typically things are backed up. COVID also played into that. I mean, it played into all of our lives. But for me, what had happened is that family members typically either misplaced or didn't do things or put things on hold because their family were going through the crisis. That's what's caused the holdup. To address your question, yes, I would get information out to schools typically within a month for the preliminary, not for the full report.
No, I just think that sometimes over 9 months, the situations may have changed in their lives. And so what you wrote may not even be applicable in some cases by 9 months later. But I'm looking to see if there's any way you could have these reports done sooner than the August deadline.
I'm trying. I am. That's my goal, too. Typically on a report, for my reports, because my OCD is pretty apparent in a lot of them, I'm trying to do 3 a week. If I can do 4 a week, that would be great. A lot of times when I'm waiting on information, I will do as much as I can do and try to get information back. I'm working as quickly as I can to try to get things taken care of.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Shreve, did you have a question?
I just want to confirm your decision to give up your license or to go inactive?
It is, yes. I mean, it would be basically surrendering my license at the end of this renewal period.
Any additional questions? We will move into deliberations. Board members, do you have any comments that you would like to make, or do we have a motion on this matter?
A motion to accept the consent form.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second. This is Brent.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Do we need a roll call vote, Ms. Galvin?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. Ms. Poe, can you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Davy?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Dr. Caterino?
Yes.
Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
Mr. Nguyen? Mr. Nguyen? Okay, yes. Thumbs up. Motion is unanimous. Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you. Thank you, MM, for joining us today. Dr. Briggs, Mr. Beardsley, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you to this board.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we can go to agenda item number 8 for Dr. Olsham's matter. He's present today.
Perfect. Thank you. Agenda item number 8, Ms. Michelson, would you please provide a summary of this matter to the board?
Yes, Madam Chair. In October of 2020, Dr. Olshan entered into a consent agreement in order with the board for a complaint that stipulated the following terms. probation for a minimum of 12 months with the provision that after 6 months and with the practice monitor's recommendation, Dr. Olshan may petition the board to request termination from probation. While on probation, he shall meet with the practice monitor for a total of 4 hours per month, and the monitor shall provide quarterly reports to the board and review 5 patient records per quarter. In addition, Dr. Olshan is required to complete 10 hours of pre-approved continuing education in the areas of ethics and record keeping and shall be completed within 6 months. Dr. Olshan met with Dr. Michael Redivo for practice monitoring from November 2020 through November 2021 of last month. Dr. Redivo did provide a monitoring plan and 4 quarterly reports to the board. In his most recent report, Dr. Redivo recommended that the practice monitoring be discontinued. Additionally, Dr. Olshan completed a total of 11 hours of CE. That was back in November of 2020. And those certificates are included in your file along with the quarterly reports from Dr. Redivo. On November 29th of this year, Dr. Olshan submitted a 2-page letter to the board requesting that probation and monitoring be terminated, which is before the board for review today. In his letter, Dr. Olshan addressed what he has learned from this process and what changes he has made to his practice. I do want to note that Dr. Olshan submitted his request to the board after the 1-year mark of probation and monitoring, rather than submitting a petition for early release at the 6-month mark. I do see that we have Dr. Olshan present. His practice monitor, Dr. Redivo, was invited today. However, I believe that he has a work conflict, and I do not think that he is present at this time. But that does conclude my summary. Please let me know if there are any questions.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Michelson? Hearing none, Dr. Olshan, thank you for joining us today. If you wouldn't mind unmuting yourself and just introducing yourself, and we'll see if the board has any questions.
Hi, I'm Dr. Neil Olshan. I first off have to apologize about my background. I'm at home in my writing office, not in my therapy office. So I just noticed how dark the background is. I apologize about that. I stand by Dr. Redivo's report and my letter to the board. It has been a very interesting year. It's been, now that I look back upon it, it's probably one of the most productive years that I've had in terms of personal growth. It took me a while to get into reviewing some of the things that some of my practices. Hopefully, I have turned my practice around to best practices. And I should say one of the reasons, I've been in private practice a long time and unfortunately was isolated. So I didn't have a lot of contact with other therapists. And that is one of the things that Dr. Redivo stressed, is that I needed to reach out. I needed to develop some relationships with other practitioners, which I've done. I'm moving forward with trying to reestablish my practice, since, as some of you might have been aware, the majority of my practice previously had been a 13-year contract with Maricopa County as a forensic psychologist with doing competency to stand trial evaluations for the court. Unfortunately, a gentleman who I did a guilty except insane evaluation at the order of the court did not like that I found him sane and evidently looked up my name on the internet. And unfortunately, the first thing that he saw was the board action. He complained to the Maricopa County Board, filed a complaint, and my contract was terminated. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is that it might be something regarding the board. If you are a psychologist working in this, they terminated it for convenience. I was not allowed to find out any information I did through some other sources. And so that represented 70% of my income. And they would not allow me to speak. They would not allow me to find out any information. And this applies to all the psychologists who are on contract with the Superior Court, which I don't think any of us were aware of having our contract terminated per convenience. The reason why I'm just bringing that up is when I said I'm reestablishing my private practice, and maybe it's a good time to do it because I'm doing it best practices. So that was a little bit of a shock. And my reason for bringing it up is I hope I can't do it, but I hope other psychologists are aware that this only applies to psychologists. It does not apply to attorneys who are working. The attorneys have a 1-year probation. After that, they cannot be fired except for cause. That does not apply to psychologists, evidently. It's my sincere hope that the board lets me move forward with my practice. I am specializing right now in people within my age category, and I found it extremely rewarding, and would like to be able to continue to help serve the community.
Thank you, Dr. Olshan. Board members, do we have any questions for Dr. Olshan? Hearing none,
Madam Chair, I would just make the statement for Dr. Olshan, it's a breath of fresh air to hear your about face with regard to the board's actions. I know that those were difficult for you to wrap your head around when we first suggested that you were going to be under practice monitoring. And after reading your letter and also the letters in progression from your practice monitor, it appears you did reset kind of your mind and your practice in the areas that we pointed out. And so I recognize that it was a difficult situation. I recognize that you had some significant feelings around the board's actions, but I am grateful to hear that this became a learning process for you. And I welcome further discussion of moving you off of probation. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Any additional comments? Do we have a motion?
I would like to make a motion that Dr. Olshan be removed from probation. Is that a motion?
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion carries. Thank you, Dr. Olshan.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I was trying to figure out if that did happen, how I would say it, but thank you. Thank you. The board works. I plan to live up to your confidence, and thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Olshan. Well, you have a lovely weekend and holiday season.
It definitely will. Thanks. And the same to the board members, and anything that I can ever do to help the board. My wife had noticed there was an opening. She says, why don't you go on the board? You've got good experience now. And I said, I'm not sure they would. I'm not sure that would be appropriate. But thank you very much, all of you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Poe. I'm going to go ahead and give out the first CE code word. If the meeting is 4 hours or longer, the first CE code word is Hanukkah. Hanukkah. Thank you.
Right.
Is it okay if I leave now?
Yes, Dr. Olshan, you are free to leave.
Have a wonderful holiday, everybody. Thank you very much.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Madam Chair, if I could offer a suggestion for the next item. We have a group here for item 14, and they have they've requested some accommodation around their availability, which is now. So if you're ready, we can move to that item.
Yes, Ms. Pakanon, that sounds great. We will now move to agenda item number 14. Ms. Pakanon, will you please provide a summary of this matter to the board?
Yes, Madam Chair and board members, just briefly, the Arizona Psychological Association, ASPA representatives did request some time on this agenda for purposes of sharing some information that has been supplied to you, mostly by way of reference, consisting of some student-directed research around psychologists and prescriptive authority. And also they've begun collecting and assembling some resources from at least one other state that does regulate psychologists with that particular privilege. So this information, again, is mostly just for purposes of we're holding on to it, and it may have some relevance, you know, as this matter develops. But I know that we have today Dr. Thomas, Dr. Berry, Dr. Ruggiero, I hope I pronounced that correctly, Dr. House, and Dr. Northrup, who have requested to address the board.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. I believe, Dr. Thomas, you have spoken with us in the past. Would you like to get started, or is there someone that you would prefer to have speak at this time?
No, we can get started, and we will try to keep this brief. Our goal today is to sort of address some of the concerns that the board expressed last month, and to kind of follow up on our discussion. So one of the questions was, has there been any research done on this? And I'd like to introduce a couple of my colleagues, Dr. Kristen Northrup, Dr. Ryan House, who completed some research on this topic. And I'm going to ask them to go ahead and present their stuff, and then I'll come back on after they've finished.
Sure, I can start, Kristen. Maybe piggyback on little things that I missed. So, not to regress too much, but it's Kristen, myself, and then also Dr. Jared Chamberlain from Midwestern University. He was along with us throughout the whole process, and again, a lot of this was kind of inspired by working with ASPA and then Dr. Bohansky at the time on their recommendation, and acknowledging there's just the huge need for more comprehensive providers, mental health providers, increase in accessibility. And so we wanted to do some research. The research was encouraged by ASPA because ASPA had done previously, you know, they've been involved in a couple legislative attempts for to increase or provide comprehensive care. And that would be through prescriptive rights through licensed psychologists with additional training, et cetera. And so they wanted to see what was the public's view, what were the students' views, what was going on. And so we put together a research proposal that was approved, and we conducted the research. We had a pretty good turnout. We had we surveyed over 400 individuals, healthcare professionals in the state of Arizona, about 150 psychologists, about 100 psychology doctoral students. We had about 50 medical physicians, currently practicing medical physicians, and then 114 medical students. And again, it was general. Kristen can speak to some of the questions that were asked, but again, we wanted to get individuals' opinions, the healthcare professionals' opinions on the state of mental health care, both on the provider side and the gap in care and the need, and then also understanding the demand, and then understanding people's opinions about psychologists, and then with that additional with that additional training and education, the opportunity to provide a specific track for licensed psychologists to get prescriptive authority. Kristen, you want to talk through maybe some of the survey questions and then some of the results?
Yeah, so I'm Kristen. Good morning, everyone. The three main questions really that we focused on, without going, too deep into, all the numbers with our research, was Do medical and mental health care professionals view or believe that there's a shortage of mental health providers? Psychologists, psychology students, and medical students all agree that there is a shortage, whereas physicians said that there's not a shortage. Do we believe that psychologists with additional training are competent to provide or to prescribe psychotropic medications? And interestingly, medical students were in agreement, as well as psychologists and psychology students. Kind of not surprising what we hypothesized before. Physicians generally disagreed, though we had some variability in the responses. And then would it result in a decreased reliance on psychotherapy? And psychologists and psychology students generally disagreed that that would be the case. So kind of the purpose of why we wanted to do the research was we've seen psychologists prescribing since the early 1990s, and I think we wanted to switch gears. In the past, you had psychologists and students wanting to, you know, prove competency or assess competency. Can psychologists do that? And we've been very lucky. We have years of research that have shown, okay, psychologists are doing this effectively and competently. So now we can shift gears and kind of focus on, you know, is this something that our profession is generally in favor of, as well as how is this going to impact the community, and is it working in the other states where they're doing it? So our research was really helpful and informative in knowing generally, obviously it's not, you know, all psychologists or students in the state, but it's a pretty good sample size that's kind of representative of where the field is going. So, you know, is this what the field wants to do? We said, okay, yes. Now let's kind of dive into existing research that's out there. Is it working in the other states? What does it look like? So we've been speaking to psychologists in other states, as well as kind of sifting through a ton of research. And just very briefly, kind of what we found, Dr. Garrett Blankenship, who's not here this morning, he just recently checked to see, and there's still no med malpractice claims against a prescribing psychologist in any of the other states. As well as more people are being seen by providers. However, psychologists are 60% less likely to put individuals on psychotropic medications and are typically seeing people for combination of therapy and medications. And as well as looking at the other programs in other states, are psychologists actually going into this, and the programs are turning out a good number of prescribing psychologists. So kind of twofold. It seems to be benefiting the communities where psychologists can prescribe, and we're able to see that generally psychologists in the state of Arizona are in favor of creating the specialty.
I think it's also important to note that this has been going on since the research started back in 2019. I appreciate that the board may feel that it's kind of coming out of maybe left field, or it's kind of almost, I don't want to say impulsive, but I want to hopefully encourage the board. Now, like, the research was conducted back in 2019. Since then, we've been meeting with medical providers, healthcare, psychologists. We've met with Dr. Sweeney, who's a psychiatrist over at Southwest Behavioral Health Services. He is their chief medical officer. He's offered his support on behalf of Southwest Behavioral and Health Services. So we're meeting with the medical field, we're meeting with the psychologist field, we're meeting with all healthcare providers, getting their feedback, and really trying to put our best foot forward and really addressing the huge need for more comprehensive healthcare providers. And again, because we want to increase accessibility and affordability to the community and to the residents of Arizona.
Thank you. Dr. Catarino, did you have a question? You're on mute.
You mentioned, Ms. Northrup, that there were no increased malpractice suits. Did you look at board complaints in every state relating to prescription providing by psychologists?
We did. And again, Dr. Blankenship kind of spearheaded that one, and we've been kind of monitoring that. And Dr. Thomas, you can chime in if you know more. But we've kind of monitored that just to make sure we have that accurate information. And I believe so far there are no med malpractice or board complaints against a prescribing psychologist. And we also have been in contact with the New Mexico board, and we're getting more information from them on kind of what it looks like to regulate those licenses, verifying if they have any complaints. But as of now, so far, we're not seeing any board complaints or med malpractice.
Thank you.
Ms. Shreve?
Who are you anticipating being the biggest opponent to this? Is it the medical, is it the doctors, the physicians in the state? I mean, who are you seeing as maybe those that are, maybe say, you know, that are raising strongest concerns?
I can address that. So historically, it's come from the Arizona Medical Association and from the psychiatrists. And so they have a well-funded lobbying program, and that's where that's come from. In the past, when we met with the Arizona Academy of Family Physicians, they basically said, we're going to be neutral because we like the idea. And in Arizona and many other states, it's family physicians that prescribe most of the psychotropics. So they like the idea of psychologists doing it. But what they told us is that their national association is against it. So they're just going to choose not to take a position. So that's been the history. And we don't think that will change. And okay. The research that Dr. House and Dr. Northrup did confirms that.
So can you briefly, because I remember we went over this last time, but just so you could remind me. So you go through get your PhD for psychology, get licensed. What is the additional education and training that you guys are proposing in regards to getting the ability to give a prescription?
It's a postdoctoral master's of science in psychopharmacology. So it's going back to school, back to a university, getting a master's degree in psychopharmacology. In the material that we submitted, along with the Sunrise document, is the kind of the format for what that education looks like.
And then training.
Right. So the training, the master's degree obviously will include a practicum or preceptorship as part of the training. And then there would be a postgraduate period where someone would prescribe under the supervision of a licensed prescriber.
Right.
So, and eventually then they would apply to the board for an independent license. So much like it is now for psychologists, you'd start out as an associate prescriber and then an independent prescriber.
Is there any kind of national exam or anything that's taken specific to that?
Yes, there's a national exam that exists for prescribing, and that's part of our proposal is that, so in addition to the master's degree, that you would pass the national licensing exam, and then complete the postgraduate period of prescribing.
So I represent the general public, so I'm not a psychologist.
That's okay. Good. I'm glad you're here.
Thanks. So I guess to me, I think as a general public, right? Do they know what they're doing? Right. That's I think the biggest concern. Do they have enough education? So can you parallel that with? I mean, it's obviously like going to get the math and the pharmaceutical and all that. Is that somewhat consistent with, let's say, nurse practitioners who can give out prescriptions? I mean, what is that? Is that education equivalent to or comparable to someone now that's giving out prescriptions? So you go, okay, that's already been associated with enough knowledge and education or whatnot to do that.
We can provide some really cool data about that, Tammy. But yes, it's if you feel comfortable getting in prescriptions by a physician assistant or by a nurse practitioner, then you should feel more comfortable than receiving prescriptions from a psychologist. The training is greater than current prescribers such as PAs or nurse practitioners. And then we can provide the data that shows that.
And I would think for someone like me, who's not a doctor or, you know, that background, that's really important, the way that that's framed. So you're paralleling it. So it's like, okay, great. Then I get it. It's equal to, or, you know, someone like you said that I do trust. We do use a physician's assistant, that kind of thing. So those are my questions. I just wanted to kind of understand that a little better. So thank you for explaining that.
Can I just say too, as a psychologist practicing in the hospital up in Northern Arizona, in primary care and other domains, we would also actually be seeing people on a weekly basis usually, as well as prescribing if that is indicated. And so you get much more contact, whereas usually our PAs and our nurse practitioners and our MDs, you know, they may see somebody every 3 months, 6 months, a year. So they're prescribing, but there's not that regular contact to really monitor at the level that I think a psychologist could.
It's a good point. Thank you. That's a really good point. All right. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Diner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had many questions that I think Ms. Shreve asked on my behalf. So thank you, Ms. Shreve. I'm a public member as well, and my main concern is the kind of training that psychologists have. So thank you for answering those questions. So right now, given that psychologists do not have prescribing privileges, if a prescription is indicated, what do psychologists do?
Currently, you would refer to a physician. And so the reality in practice is you refer to a physician or a nurse practitioner or a PA. In the private practice world, sometimes people wait months to get an appointment with a psychiatrist. It takes a long time to be seen. More commonly, you might work with someone's primary care physician and then collaborate with them and regarding this, you know, person needs an antidepressant or something along that line. And so it's a collaborative practice. That's typically how it works. Dr. Ruggiero practices in a hospital. It's probably more collaborative in that environment than it would be in private practice. And then in a lot of the community public behavioral health agencies, they have prescribers on staff, but it takes a while for those folks to get seen. And oftentimes the consult is done through telehealth with a prescriber in another state.
So are you suggesting that with this specialty for psychologists having prescribing privileges, that collaboration would stop or would reduce in some fashion?
No, I think it's important to note also in a perfect world, if for psychologists, if they feel like some type of psychotropic intervention was appropriate, they would refer to someone who's trained in psychology and mental health and with prescribing authority. So that would be a psychiatrist. Right now, unfortunately, if that situation were to happen, that patient would be waiting anywhere between 2 and 6 months before they could actually get into a psychiatrist, someone who's been trained both in prescribing and in psychology. So most likely what happens is they defer to their primary care physician who has significant training in the medical field and in prescribing, but not an appropriate diagnosis of mental health disorders. And I want to make a key something important to note here is appropriate diagnosis drives treatment. And so the medical field right now, primary care physicians, et cetera, they're trained in treatment, but they're not trained in mental health psychology diagnosis. And so you would then be deferring to the primary care physician, most of which are typically not wanting to practice. They're motivated to practice within their scope of competency. And a lot of the times pushing into certain prescripting and psychotropics pushes them out of that comfort zone for them. So in a perfect world, you have that integrated care where we have that discussion and that collaboration. Realistically, in the real world, that's not really happening.
And also, go ahead.
Oh, you're ahead.
Oh, just to note too, actually, you almost see an increase in collaboration with prescribing psychologists because in other states, there's actually legal mandates for a psychologist to collaborate with a PCP. So psychologists know when to refer to a medical professional, but they also are included a mandate to where you have to collaborate with a PCP. So here in Arizona, we would kind of take on a similar model. So there's that collaborative piece and working with individuals and getting them connected to a PCP and then monitoring their care with the PCP. So you don't have to consult to prescribe, but you're just consulting regarding their care and their treatment. So everyone's kind of on the same page.
Yeah, may I just add, so I'm a psychologist working in Northern Arizona for Flagstaff Medical Center, Verde Valley Medical Center, and there's 5 primary care centers. And so the practice currently is monthly meetings with all the primary cares. So we can talk and collaborate about each of the patients that we're sharing. We also invite some of our psychiatry in, but they're so busy with inpatient, they actually don't. They were able to come in a little bit more during the pandemic when some of our inpatients were closed, but they're very cut off because there's just not enough. So then when about 80% of the prescribing happens with the primary care, and I can tell you they're very uncomfortable with that. Right now we work with it with a lot of collaboration. They really want to know what I'm seeing in the week-to-week progress with the patient and what they're prescribing, but usually they'll prescribe 1 or 2 or maybe 3 different medications. But if it gets any more complicated than that, they don't want to do it. And so then it needs to go out to a psychiatrist. And in Verde Valley, that is pretty much Spectrum. That's a community mental health center. And so they can take a certain load, but there's really on and off, we'll have another private practice psychiatrist, but it's pretty limited. There's a few in Flagstaff area, but we've got Williams and I mean, there's a whole bunch of, you know, surrounding smaller towns, and the demand is just too high. And most of the people just have unmet need. For me, one of the concerns is I establish a rapport with a patient. We built a relationship. Their primary care is no longer feeling competent to prescribe the medications or the complications that they're having. And they're reluctant to go and establish care with yet another prescriber. And so sometimes it takes months just to talk them into trusting someone else, telling their story to someone else. It's like they keep having to expand their care team when really I think the primary care provider and the psychologist could really work, you know, very collaboratively together and successfully without having to cause them, you know, yet another prescriber that may be unnecessary and difficult for them.
So how does, thank you for that explanation that that informed me about a few things I wasn't aware of. So thank you. So my next question is, how does your Sunrise application square with the current efforts, or I should say the more recent efforts to curtail or restrict prescription of narcotic drugs?
So the plan would be that, we don't want to restrict the prescription of if you restrict the prescription of opiates, you actually restrict the prescription of medications like methadone and Suboxone, which are used to help people get off of opiates. And so we wouldn't want to restrict that. One of the things that will be in there is that psychologists will not engage in pain management. And that's where a lot of the prescriptions for opiates are taking place. And so that would not be a scope of practice for prescribing psychologists. That would be, so it, like it isn't, it's not in New Mexico, it's off the table. But you can prescribe methadone or Suboxone if you're working with people in substance abuse recovery, which as we've spoken to legislators, that is a big focus for them right now. They're very aware of kind of the rash of opiate abuse and very concerned about that. So that would be an area where a prescribing psychologist could work. But as far as like, you know, you wouldn't see psychologists prescribing Vicodin or OxyContin or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there'd be no increase in opioid prescriptions. The only time this would become applicable if a psychologist were to be treating an individual for a substance abuse disorder, and that would be obviously to try to get them off of, you know, the, you know, whatever substance that they had built some tolerance to or dependence upon.
That's all my questions, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Dr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, thank you for your presentation. I would suggest caution about saying that physicians are not trained to make mental health diagnoses. That's not true, and I think you'd get some substantial pushback from a good section of them, and we don't want to cause any additional problems in arguing for this. The question I had was, in your surveys, did you look at interest by Arizona psychologists in pursuing this? That was one of the questions we previously had, was how many psychologists do we think are going to engage in prescription services?
We did not include that specifically in our research. This was done while we were still students, and I think we were kind of just wanting to get general attitudes. We have heard that question, and I think it would be super valuable. So because we did not include that, we've looked at, and I don't have exact numbers off the top of my head, but we're happy to send any kind of information anyone would want, kind of as supportive knowledge. But we've been looking at other programs just to see, are there psychologists actually going into the programs and graduating and becoming practitioners? And we've seen in the other programs that they are turning out a pretty substantial amount of prescribers. So we kind of generalize, hoping that's kind of what we're going to see in Arizona. But that also is something I think we probably could pursue.
Okay, thank you. The other question would be kind of in lines with that, if you're looking at additional information, is what impact is this going to have on access to prescription services? If we're talking about kind of incorporating meds into current weekly therapy practice of psychologists, how many clients are they going to actually see for medication that would kind of help meet the need for psychotropic medication?
Well, initially, that would probably be a smaller number. And then as the number of practitioners grow, the number of patients seen would increase. The experience in New Mexico is that the place where it's made the biggest difference there is in rural New Mexico. It doesn't seem to have the largest impact in the major metropolitan areas, but it has increased accessibility for people in rural areas.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Katerina? You are on mute.
Sorry. Are you aware of any insurance company codes or reimbursement for psychologists prescribing? Because the reason why it takes 2 to 6 months or more in Arizona are because many of the psychiatrists don't take insurance. And if it happens again that psychologists would get this privilege and not take insurance, then because maybe insurance companies that don't fund it, then we'd be in the same position. Maybe a few more people can prescribe, but many more people can't afford the cost of a private pay psychologist as they can't afford the cost of a private psychiatrist. So there would need to be work, I think, with insurance companies to accept psychologists and to reimburse. And that maybe is done in the other states. I don't know if that's been looked at.
So insurance companies do reimburse psychologists in the other states. That is part of the practice. Whether an individual chooses to be paneled on an insurance company and accept their rate of reimbursement that's a professional choice that people make. And so there's no way to predict how many people would get paneled on insurance companies and how many people would do a cash practice and how many people would work in public behavioral health. It's hard to know. To speculate on that. But we do know that insurance companies recognize that and reimburse. in the other states.
I do know, and
that's I didn't know that, but I did want to, I think that if the case is that rural populations need to be served and it needs to be affordable for and different from the medical personnel that prescribe. And you're right, you can't mandate that. But if that's going to be the case, I think we'd have to see if it is going to be any different at all. So, but at least they do reimburse. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Northup, did you want to add a comment to that?
Yeah, I was just going to mention that was kind of one of the general concerns I think we had, and then that we've kind of been researching as well, as we've heard kind of the term, will you become like junior psychiatrists where you're just like cranking out patients and not taking insurance. And psychiatrists are doing the best they can. They're super overburdened. There's a lot of people who need care. It doesn't, you know, just fall on one profession. So that again is where we have to look at the data that we have from other states, and more psychologists are in community mental health in these other states. Whereas psychiatrists are typically private pay or private insurance. And so you have a little bit more of a distribution of where you see psychologists. So the prescribers are typically going to be seen more in community mental health as well as some of the rural areas. And so again, we can't, it's really difficult to predict exactly how that would look here. But again, we've really, really focused on that and through kind of researching some stuff just to see what that looks like in other states. Cause the goal isn't, you know, just to have more prescribers, but there's really no increase in access to care.
Thank you. Ms. Shreve.
You explain, I'm just trying to generally, so if you're a psychologist, you know, you're charging X amount of dollars an hour typically, right? So if you get a license or approval to do prescriptions and all that extra education, how much more, I mean, would there be, I'm assuming a higher hourly rate? Is that rate then whether you give a prescription or not, or only if you give a prescription? How does that work in the states that are currently have psychologists that provide prescriptions?
So the way it works is with billing codes. And so what happens is that a prescribing psychologist has access to billing codes that a non-prescribing psychologist is unable to use. And so the rate of reimbursement is determined by the individual insurance companies, determined by Medicare and Central Medical Services.
No. Excuse me. Make sure you're on mute, please, unless you've requested to speak. Thank you. I'm sorry, Dr. Thomas. I'm not sure what, but if go ahead.
That's okay. So that's how the reimbursement gets figured. And so what happens is there will be procedure codes that a prescribing psychologist can bill for. So you may bill for an hour of psychotherapy. You may bill for some time for prescribing. You may use a code for med management. So sometimes if you go in and you see a physician and how are you doing, everything's good, the meds are working good, that's great. They bill for med management even though they haven't changed the prescription. And so it's those type of codes that prescribing psychologists would have access to.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it. Just trying to wrap my head around it. Thanks.
Yeah.
And if I could, again, just speak to integrated healthcare, it is a little bit different than specialty mental health care. Of course, the hospital provides us with the support to be on many insurance panels. And a lot of times, behavioral health is not a lucrative area for the hospital, but it's a necessary one, and they see that. And so a lot of the patients that I see, they don't have a copay. It's covered because it's different kind of health, it's different kind of billing codes in the hospital integrated healthcare setting than specialty mental health care. And so it makes it so much more accessible, people that would not be getting receiving care. So I don't know how that would translate with billing codes for providers, the prescriptions, but I assume it might follow along the same way.
Thank you, Mr. Diner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one more question while I was kind of figuring a few things out. So tell me if I'm understanding this correctly. So whoever has this master's and applies for a prescription privilege from this board, assuming all of the qualifications are there, training is there, the board grants them the authority to prescribe medication. Would a behavior analyst be also be able to take the master's and then have prescribing privileges, or is it just for PsychDs or PhDs?
It would require a doctoral degree in psychology. So there may be some behavior analysts that have a doctoral degree in psychology, but part of the licensing is that the person is licensed as a psychologist. So I am aware that there are people that are dually licensed as psychologists and behavior analysts. So that individual certainly could get a master's degree in psychopharmacology.
So in other words, you would need two things, right? You would need the doctorate degree in psychology, and you would need a license to practice as a psychologist from this board before you can obtain the specialty license for prescribing privileges. Am I correct?
That is correct. That is the way it works in other states.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Shreef?
I'm sorry, just to clarify. So if they're really a go-getter, you know, A-type personality, and can they get the PhD, and then while they're doing an internship or whatever, then getting the master's, or do they have to have the license before? Are you suggesting they have to have the license before they start the master's program? Or is there a way to parallel a little bit? Just trying to clarify.
That would be regulated by universities. And so that would have more to do with the admission requirements that a university would set for that program. I don't know that the Psychological Association can regulate that. And I don't know if the Board of Examiners can regulate that as well.
Oh, but you just said they'd have to have a license. I mean, if they get, in order to get your license, you'd need to get your PhD and then all of your, you know, internships and whatever, and postdocs or whatever you need. And so, you know, there's a lot of time where you're just working as a student. So can they be getting their master's at that time, or do they have to have their license before they start?
It's a postdoctoral master's degree. So most of the, I believe all of the programs require that you have a doctoral degree in psychology to be able to apply.
But not a license, just a doctorate degree. That's what I want to confirm, because I think that's not what Dr. Dinard mentioned, the license, because those are two different things.
Correct.
So yep. You're saying the postdoctorate degree, the way you're proposing it in your language, the legislature be a postdoctorate degree is obtained, and then they can work on the master's.
Correct. But okay. In order to, go ahead, Dr. House.
Yeah, I think you can be meeting the requirements of the licensure process, you know, concurrently. So Midwestern offers like a neuropsychologist tract. So if I was just going to get a clinical psychologist degree, then that's a 4-year tract. For individuals that want a specialty in neuropsychology, there's a 5-year tract, and they stay on for another year or two. They have additional academic training, they have additional clinical trainings, and then they don't graduate with their degree until they've met all of those requirements. And then they submit all that criteria to the board, and they kind of make sure all those boxes have been checked, met all the requirements, and then they get licensure.
I understand that. I guess the question was, Dr. Thomas said you had to be licensed before you went for your master's degree in pharmaceutical. And my question is, do you have to be licensed, I'm just trying to question, what is your proposed legislation say, or do you just have to have your degree? A lot of people have a degree, but not a license.
Right. You have to be licensed as a psychologist to apply for the license as a prescribing psychologist.
Okay.
So anybody can get education, right? But you have to have a license in order to practice.
Okay. You're still not understanding them. Maybe I'm
so
not.
So for instance, I'm aware that
what I'm asking is, do you need to be licensed as a psychologist? Because that's what you said before you go get your master's. And I think the answer is no. I think you don't need to be licensed by the state of Arizona. You can get it. You just need to have the psychology, the PhD in psychology.
Yes, you need to have licensable education, but you don't have to be licensed.
Okay, that's it. When we use the word license, we mean licensed with Arizona. So, okay.
Licensable education requirements in order to get there.
Two different things. All right, thank you.
Any additional questions? Dr. Davey.
So I'm going to preface my questions with, my questions are going to be hard, but please realize that I'm still very much neutral on this. And so I'm going to ask a couple of just questions from a different point of view. So the first one is around scope of practice, right? And so traditionally, psychologists, this has not been included in your scope of practice as prescribers, both nationally here and in the state. I recognize the movement. I read through the research, the poster, as well as the presentation on the slides. I looked a little bit at what was going on in Idaho because I have some contacts there. I did not look at New Mexico, but I will take a look at that as well. So when we think about scope of practice, psychology is pretty much tied in assessment, diagnosis, correction of mental, emotional, psychological behavior abilities. I think that's kind of the scope that is in our current statutes. And so when we look at expanding that scope, right, if we're going to add that there's now going to be a specialty practice for prescribing psychologists. If you had to give me the top three reasons as to what is driving this, I think I've heard access, I've heard community need. Like, based on the research you've done, what are those top three reasons that would compel this board, as well as, or even prior to this board, I guess the legislature, to want to open up that scope of service that, quite honestly, is going to cross with other scopes of practice or intersect with other scopes of practice?
I have one that just kind of comes to mind. And I think, and Dr. Thomas knows a little more on this, but I think overall it's not necessarily increasing a psychologist scope of practice. So a regular practicing psychologist would remain the same. It's adding that specialty and increasing scope for a prescribing psychologist. What comes to mind as one of the top impacts, and I obviously am pretty new in the field, but just kind of what I've been seeing and through talking with psychiatrists and psychologists about treatment is a more comprehensive treatment. So I was at an inpatient psych unit for my internship and had a lot of discussions with the NPs and psychologists there. What we would see is a lot of people come in for treatment and we medicate symptoms, especially difficult symptoms, and then we release them. And then they kind of cycle back through the system. They're placed on medications. You're seeing this. Ryan was an outpatient. You're seeing a very similar thing going on in outpatient. And I think it has a lot to do, again, it doesn't fall in one profession. It's not the NPs or psychiatry. It's just a matter of resources and what people are able to do with care right now. And I think you take trauma, you might medicate the symptoms of trauma, but then we're not actually addressing, we're kind of putting a Band-Aid on it without addressing kind of some of the underlying issues. And I think what's really cool in the other states, Dr. Marquez, who's the first civilian prescriber in New Mexico, he said he saw people for a combination of therapy and medication, and he was actually taking more people off meds, but keeping the people on that really needed to be on medications. But he said he had really, really awesome outcomes with children, especially, and kind of taking them off of some of those like heavy hitter medications that they might be stuck on. And he kind of attested to that idea that you really can dive in, you can treat trauma, you can treat other disorders through maybe behavioral interventions, recognizing when medication is necessary. But people are just having better treatment outcomes. You can see that in research. And, I know talking to one psychologist is just one person, but the other ones we've spoken to as well kind of say the same thing. So from my point of view, I think the comprehensive treatment, really being able to treat someone and help them really to end up with better outcomes and to feel better.
What would be the others then? So we've got comprehensive treatment. I get that essentially a psychologist that their scope was expanded to from prescribing would be able to take someone from diagnosis through emotional behavioral or through assessment, then through some sort of treatment. And then now also have the added benefit of being able to prescribe certain medications under certain circumstances. So I've got that one. All right.
I think one takeaway is, I think as psychologists, we are, and whether you're a psychologist, you are a PA, a physician, a dermatologist, whatever field you are, we're all healthcare professionals. We're all here to help serve our community. I think what's clear across the whole spectrum of providers is that there is a gross shortage of providers, specifically within the mental health field. And the medical field has done what we can see as their part to try to increase access to care, whether that's affordability or, again, increase the quantity of providers. They provided the nurse practitioner tract. They created the physician assistant tract to try to meet this demand for more providers. But yet there's still a huge gap in care. Psychologists, we are mental health care providers. And one of the major tools in treating mental health care is psychotropic intervention. But yet we as mental health care providers don't carry that tool in our toolbox. And so as we as healthcare professionals continue to strive to meet the needs of our community, I think it's what we're doing in order to try to solve that. We're trying to increase care, put another tool in our toolbox, and provide comprehensive care to the people that need it most.
Dr. Davey, I would point out that part of prescription privileges is the ability to unprescribe medication. So I've had numerous experiences, particularly with adolescents that come in heavily medicated and oftentimes getting prescriptions from more than one provider and trying to sort that out and say, can we get you off some of these medications? So is as much as being able to prescribe, the prescriptive authority gives someone the ability to take an individual off medication. And I think that's a key piece of this. And I think the research backs up that psychologists do a little bit more of that because of the comprehensive treatment that Dr. Northrup, Dr. House were talking about.
So Dr. Thomas, can you explain a little bit about that on the research? I mean, do we have the numbers of, from state of Idaho of, number of prescriptions provided versus those that are unprescribed as we kind of look at, let's just say, lower levels of care in the system?
I don't know who tracks that data and how to have access to that. I don't know that we could find that for Arizona. Idaho is the most recent state to pass this. So their program is in its infancy, and I can't speak to how many prescribing psychologists there even are in the state of Idaho. But imagine that number is small.
Yeah. I think we talked a little bit about that last time.
Yeah.
I've noticed the so where a lot of the numbers come from, and they'll cite the research, is the State Psychological Association. So specifically, if you look at Illinois, they've kind of cited what prescribing they have. I think they have kind of a page dedicated to what it looks like there. And they have, I do know off the top of my head, they said their prescribing psychologists are 60% less likely to prescribe psychotropic medications than a medical professional. So typically the State Psychological Associations and the prescribing states are kind of good resources for some of that information.
I appreciate those answers. I think that's, I see the value in those areas. I'm going to follow up with that. So let's just look at this from, I want to just kind of shift the question a little bit. So You mentioned behavior analysts. We're not, Mr. Diner, not interested most likely in the prescribing side of the world. There are doctorate level behavior analysts that reside in our state. You know, you talk about kind of this access to care issue. You talk about the fact of being able to provide maybe more holistic diagnosis to treatment, kind of end-to-end services, integrated services, collaborative services to patients. From my perspective, what comes to mind is, you know, not too many years ago, as behavior analysts came online in this state and were seeking to be able to provide behavioral health services, that there was such, you know, such concern with regard to scope of practice by not only this board that we now reside in, but also other boards that at the time the governor was looking at placing us in. So much so that our statute actually is one of the only statutes that I'm aware of across the country that includes a statement of what we do not do. Like, we had to include that to be able to appease multiple behavioral health professionals that were concerned about what behavior analysts were going to mean to their profession and how we were going to essentially cut into the things we do. You know, fast forward multiple years now, and that did not come to light. What came to light was there was a huge need for behavior analysts in this state, and there's been a huge growth of behavior analysts in this state, and there's been a huge increase to access to services. So as my point to this is, one of the things that, you know, we often run into is bottlenecks in diagnosis. There's only so many groups out there, or so many professionals that are allowed to provide the diagnosis of a child with a developmental disability, an intellectual disability, and that is a bottleneck to treatment. That is psychologists, that is developmental pediatricians, that is psychiatrists. And so I would just, you know, I sit there and I wonder if we're having the same discussion about behavior analysts being all of a sudden being able to take a specialty course in diagnostics or psychometrics, would there be the same appeasement to expanding or adding to a licensed behavior analyst scope the ability to provide that diagnosis? And so the same reasons you list of why that would be important, I feel like I could make that those same arguments for behavior analysts to be able to diagnose. And so I just sit here and I wonder about that. I don't necessarily need you all to comment on it, but I want to share with you where my mind goes and what the reaction was not so many years ago as we looked at bringing on individuals. I'll pause if you have any comments, but otherwise I'll get to actual questions. So I'll pause to the question. I think Ms. Northrup, probably towards you, Dr. House as well. On the presentation you gave, both the poster and then the slides you provided, you know, lots of, you know, conclusions, lots of benefits. What are the risks? Like, as you looked at these other states and they brought forth the ability to be able to do this, what, you know, when I think about a, you know, a good journal article, right, we get through all the results, the, you know, the discussion, you know, there's always a discussion of what the limitations are. There's always a discussion of what the potential risks might be, right? So what do those look like to the public? What do those look like to the system?
I know one off the top of my head is probably the same risks that medical professionals are seeing with prescribing. There's contraindications, there's comorbid diagnoses. While the training, our training is meant to ensure that we're competent to prescribe the same way medical school might be or school for becoming a nurse practitioner, it's a lot of the same risks that kind of come with providing treatment and providing and engaging in practice. And I think that can be very individualized, but I would say one of the main ones is any kind of malpractice. And again, you might see that same kind of risk along with other professions who are prescribing. Ryan, I don't know if you have any as well, or Dr. Thomas.
Yeah, I think one of the risks, we took it from a lens also, what are the risks for the psychology field? What are potential risks that some psychologists may anticipate? And one of those, I think it was a direct question that we had in our survey was, would psychologists then become more dependent upon prescribing opposed to conventional training interventions such as any other type of psychotherapy? And what we found, both on an anecdotal and a research basis, just that just doesn't seem to be the case. Again, psychologists typically go, their first line of defense is some type of psychotherapy intervention. Should that not be supported, or they're not getting the results they feel like they need to, then typically some type of psychotropic intervention is usually second, third option.
And so really not, we haven't really, other than maybe aligning what potential risks are out there with other prescribers in the field, really no questions that have been asked about what the potential risk could be to consumers. We just believe that they'll be in line with other professionals that provide the same kind of service.
Well, we would have hopefully deduced that from any type of malpractice suits or claims that would have been filed, and there just are zero. So we would have been able to do some type of information from there. But then again, there has not been any malpractice claims. So it'd be hard to gather that information.
Okay. I appreciate it. I'll pause there. Thank you.
Does anybody else have any additional questions? I don't have any questions, but I do have a few comments. My doctorate is in integrated healthcare. I did a DBH focused on management of integrated healthcare systems. I focused on rural community health home for the special needs child. And so I find that I really do find that this approach is progressive, but necessary. I think that there are so many segmented and fragmented systems of care just within our state alone that are just exorbitantly restricting access to healthcare and behavioral health services. And so I'm a big fan of this. I'm also a mother of a child with special needs. And I know that Dr. House, you had mentioned a psychiatrist wait as being 2 to 6 months. I will tell you, in the pediatric world, it's more like 18 months. It is not pretty. It is not pleasant. And if you want it, you know, my son sees about 7 different specialty providers. And so we wanted it all to be housed in one place. And that wait was going to be even longer. So we ended up having to now go to a different location for these services, instead of trying to figure out how to a way to integrate his care so that we're not spending all of our time at hospitals and doctor's offices. So I want to comment on the board members' questions, because I think that we got to get this right and we got to make sure we're safe, we're protecting the public. But I do want to also just express, one, how appreciative I am of you guys coming prepared today for these questions. I think of all of the conversations that we've had, this has been one of the ones that you guys have been able to really formulate the questions or the responses. To, you know, my colleagues on the board, I really want to make sure that we're looking at, again, all of the healthcare systems of care issues. And yes, the practice issues are a risk and they're present. But again, we have a lot of people not accessing care at all or accessing the wrong care. And I think that that is also detrimental, because when we're dealing with mental health, especially in the pediatric world, the sooner we can get in, I mean, mental health, and why it's not lucrative to hospitals, right, is because all of it relies on preventative, right? If we can do preventative maintenance of mental health, then we can prevent long-term healthcare costs. And so we really have to be in kind of this mindset of, what are we going to do to get in front of some of these systemic issues that we're seeing as a field. So I've enjoyed this conversation. I have appreciated the questions you board members have had to the group that's here. And I appreciate the group for coming forth and relentlessly trying to push this, because I understand kind of the mission, and I understand why it's going to be and why it is important to our community. Having said that, any additional questions? Are we still, just for point of clarification, are we still just kind of in an exploratory? Is there an actual ask or a motion that we need to have before us today? I don't know, Dr. Thomas, if you have.
No, I would just point out And I appreciate your comments, Dr. Wilson. I would just point out that this board does have a history of being progressive and being bold. Arizona is one of the first states to approve SIPACT. This board has been very successful in integrating behavior analysts in, and I think it works well. And so there's experience of, okay, how do we bring a new profession in and make it work? There's history of being able to do that. So I just appreciate your time and allowing us to be here this morning. I anticipate that we'll be back and speak with you again. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Shreve.
So are you planning on, when do you plan on submitting proposed legislation?
So we have submitted the Sunrise document. It's at the legislature. They have, it has been referred to the Joint Committee on Health. They have not scheduled a hearing. As soon as we know anything like that, we'll be sure to let Ms. Packinen know. And so all of you will know pretty promptly, I assume.
Perfect. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think one quick note is I do appreciate you guys' time. Thanks for asking all the questions. Keep in mind, please keep the communication open. If there's anything you need from us, let us know in real time. We should be able to respond. This has been work that's been going on for multiple years, and there is only 4 or 5 of us kind of championing this cause. So we're meeting with other healthcare professionals. We're meeting with other potential stakeholders, trying to raise money, like just doing all the things. So we are motivated. We're here. And then again, please reach out in real time and we'll try to get back to you with any information or supporting documentation that you may have.
Thank you. Thank you guys very much for joining us. And if there's any new information that you come across, please do share with board staff so that they can disseminate it out to us. And we appreciate your guys's time and would appreciate continued updates.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I was just going to suggest that we consider Agenda item 9 next, but only if Mr. Nguyen is going to be available. He's being pulled in a couple of different directions today, but I'm getting the affirmative that he's available. We have a recusal for this item, so I wanted to ensure we had a quorum.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Nguyen. We could move to agenda item number 9. Dr. Catarino is recused from this item. Ms. Packinon, would you please provide a summary to the board?
Yes, Madam Chair. So the board will recall that it held a special meeting back on October 26th for purposes of reviewing the ruling issued by Maricopa County Superior Court relative to this complaint 2014. The ruling included some findings on behalf of the board, some findings on behalf of the respondent, Dr. Sade. And so the issue before the board on October 26th was whether to appeal the court's ruling. The board elected to not appeal that ruling and instead to schedule this complaint for another informal hearing at a future date in early 2022. But in the interim, propose a possible settlement of the case to Dr. Sade. Dr. Sade was sent that consent agreement containing the terms that the board offered, which did include disciplinary action. Dr. Sade, in turn, is notifying the board that she is rejecting this settlement offer and proposed her own settlement for the board's consideration. And so I believe Dr. Sade is here and she can be afforded an opportunity to present her counteroffer to the board at this time.
Thank you. Dr. Sade, I believe you are here. If you would not mind unmuting yourself, introducing yourself, and you may make a statement to the board at this time.
Hi, thank you. I was the board in receipt of the written settlement counteroffer that I received or yes, that I sent? Sure. Okay, I will just rely on my written response and I'm available to answer questions if anybody has some.
Perfect. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Dr. Sade? All right. Hearing none, we will move into deliberation. Does anybody have any comments? Ms. Shreve?
Yeah.
Yes. Can I ask? I'd like to request going to executive session for legal advice.
I'll second that motion.
We have a motion and a second to go into executive session for the purpose of legal advice. Any further discussion?
I just wanted to ask one clarifying question of Dr. Sade before we go, if that's possible, Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Dr. Sade, at the end of your letter, that you state that you've taken already 3 hours in record keeping and treatment planning CEUs, which are what you could find available, that you were willing to listen to the board to be able to identify some other coursework that might be also in line with some of the areas that we think would benefit you. Is it your position at this point that that in a discussion with the board that you are willing to continue on with some additional CEUs?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries.
Madam Chair, Ms. Poe, were you able to? Oh, thank you.
Dr. Caterino is recused. Everyone else is here.
All right.
I am here. Should I not be here?
No, you can be here. I would prefer you turn off your video and audio. Is Dr. Sade back? Yes.
Yes.
Yes, I am here.
Thank you. Dr. Sade, I do believe we have some questions for you. Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dr. Sade, do you have camera ability? Can we ask that, Ms. Galvin?
I was not prepared to be on camera today. Oh, I did not know that I would be speaking. I thought it was like the last meeting.
Okay, that's okay. Just asking. Fine, thanks.
Dr. Sade, thank you for being here. A question about your counterproposal. To me, it sounds like you're thinking there were no findings of fact of problematic practice or wrongdoing based on the most recent court hearing, as opposed to there still being acknowledgement of concerns about documentation practices and about lack of informed consent, and what I'm also trying to figure out is I had some concerns about dual relationships, but that was not. That was the issue that was not found to be properly evaluated at the court. And so I'm trying to figure out, do we need to go back and do an informal hearing again to see, is there evidence to proceed with that concern versus kind of just seeing where you're at. I mean, could you just briefly explain to me kind of where you, or if you see yourself having made mistakes or would do anything differently about this, a similar case moving forward?
With all due respect, I would rather answer that in a proceeding that follows due process. I've found that if I make statements to this board, they're used against me.
Okay.
Dr. Mike, can I rephrase the question? So what we're asking for is, through this whole process, has there been growth, Dr. Sade? Like, has there been areas where you've, you know, personally made improvements? Are there areas that you have strengthened through this process outside of the three credits that you've taken so far?
Well, the impact of this proceeding on my life has been profound. It has forever changed me. I no longer treat children. I no longer work for the courts. So, are you looking to see whether I've grown from this? That's a loaded question. It's changed me in ways that I may never recover from. So I have that's all I have to say.
I appreciate the answer. I think we were looking for something around your practice, understanding that the personal impact maybe is front and foremost for you. We were looking more on the lines around your practice, your professional practice. So,
what is the question specifically?
The question is like, with regard to informed consent, have you made adjustments to how that's gathered for your practice?
Well, your question implies that there was no informed consent. And for that, I don't understand what else I could have done. And that's what's confusing here. So you have evidence of informed consent, but you're not accepting it.
So is it fair to say that in terms of the way you gather informed consent or keep those records, that there has not been change, or that you're not wanting to share what changes have been made?
It depends on the type of client. So, I mean, this case, this board has not reviewed any of my cases involving typical counseling services or evaluation services. And so I don't know if that's what you want me to speak to. I no longer do work for the courts. This board has scared me off of that. So there's no concern that I would be, even though I feel like I have the right to do it, I shouldn't be limited. But if I couldn't have documented informed consent in this case, I don't know how I could do it for this board, given the context of that case, that court informed services. There was informed consent. The only person who didn't agree with that was the complainant. So that's all. Unless you have a more specific hypothetical or something like that, I don't know what to say.
I appreciate you opening up with this, and I'll leave it there. And unless Dr. Meyer would like to be a little bit different in his question. Thank you for sharing.
Ms. Shreve.
Thank you. And again, thanks for being here and for answering our questions. Question I have is, one of the issues that was raised was record keeping, and just wanting to see, I know you took some CE credits, but you know, as we all learn in our professions, you know, little something, have you learned, or how do you feel like you've strengthened your record keeping with those credits? Do you feel like you've you know, seen or maybe learned some new ideas on that, or maybe more, how is that? What have you done, if anything, with your practice in order to strengthen that skill set?
Well, my understanding of what made this case difficult was the manner in which I was keeping my records. I was keeping it in a way that was not organized in a traditional manner. I no longer do that work. And so the collaboration, the intersection between law and psychology, I don't do that anymore. But in my private practice, I use a record keeping system. I have detailed treatment plans. I keep my progress notes, the learning, you know, I can always learn more. I don't bill insurance, never have, don't plan to. Yes, I'm not opposed to learning. I enjoy learning. At no point did I say my record keeping couldn't be improved. I'm a younger psychologist and I'm open to being, to improving my practices. But the line that was crossed here was, the accusation of unprofessional conduct. And that's, I don't know.
And I wanted to focus just on the record keeping, and you answered, I appreciate it. Yeah, and I think, you know, we all live and learn. And it appears as though you've taken those credits, which are on record keeping. So thanks. That was I appreciate the response.
Do we have additional questions for Dr. Sade? All right. Hearing none, do we have a direction board members wish to proceed?
I'm inclined to say an informal hearing is needed to follow the procedures to further explore the evidence.
And is that a motion?
More along the line of discussion to see what other people think.
Perfect. So we are discussing the proposal potentially to decline the counter offer and proceed with the informal hearing. Do we have other thoughts for Dr. Meyer?
I'm kind of leaning more towards, and this is just deliberations or discussion, is more the non-disciplinary agreement with continuing education credits. I appreciate her comments. It seems that she's, you know, in regards to, you know, she's living, learning about record keeping. I think I feel more like that would be I would feel more comfortable with that.
Yeah, I guess I'm concerned when she says the only person that didn't think there was informed consent was the patient. That's a pretty important party for this. That's who informed consent is supposed to come from. Mm-hmm. And there did not seem to be any concern that she did something wrong or that she would do something differently. And so I think that record keeping, I agree. She's done additional continuing education, acknowledges that, but the informed consent has me very concerned.
Would you feel more comfortable if we required her to take, you know, a certain amount of CEU credits on informed consent?
Taking a class doesn't change behavior when you don't think that that's an issue that you need to further develop or correct. I mean, when she says she couldn't have done anything differently, I can sit through 3 hours of information, but it's not going to change my behavior or practice. And so it's that she doesn't see there's issues to address suggests to me that non-disciplinary and voluntary continuing education will not do anything in service of protecting the public from future concerns about informed consent in her practice.
Do we have
Is it appropriate for Dr. Sade to respond to that? I mean, I think that that would be an important thing for us to hear, is like what her thoughts are around that, if that's a fair characterization of her current mindset.
I would like to, if that's okay.
Yes, I think that will help the board better understand and adjudicate the issue.
Right. This was a case where, first of all, I don't know what kind of informed consent Dr. Meyer is concerned about. The activities that the board was concerned about were participated in by the father, who was a legal guardian, who provided a declaration to the board that he consented to everything. Dr. Mellon, who was the court-appointed therapeutic interventionist, upon who had the parents had to comply with her recommendations, consented to everything. And so when the question is, I mean, that's confusing to me. When the parent says, I consented to everything, I don't know what else I could have done to convince this board that there was consent. If I'm misunderstanding it, let me know.
So,
Ms. Shreve.
So, Dr. Sade, in regards to informed consent, can you just tell the board maybe what is your, I mean, obviously it's important. What is your process for that? How do you, if holistically, what are your thoughts on informed consent? Is it something that's always completed? I understand what you're saying about this case and what your perspective of it, but just regards to informed consent. Can you just-
Sure. Yeah, generally speaking, in a not court informed, not just a regular traditional case, especially when I work with a minor, I do check in, check out with the parent usually, so that they're aware of what is happening in the sessions, you know, which topics we're going to be addressing, what techniques we're going to be using, because that home and collaboration is essential, especially because I do attachment-based work, where we're often repairing parent-child relationships. So parents are very included in my sessions. When there's parents who aren't able to participate for various reasons, I send email updates to them saying, this is where we're at, here's what we're working on. Please let me know if you have questions. So if anything, that's what's confusing to me is perhaps more than most practitioners, include parents in my sessions. When it comes to adults, I do see adults and, you know, obviously I have my standard form that people sign when we begin, but there is such a thing as ongoing consent. I don't know during intake what techniques are going to be needed at various stages of therapy. So I does that help?
Right. So the general practice is informed consent is used in this case from a perspective, perspective of what you stated, it was completed, but I think we just wanted to get a feel of your philosophy or your thoughts on informed consent.
Thank you. Dr. Meyer.
So, Dr. Sade, did you obtain informed consent about involving massage therapy and treatment?
Yes, it's in fact in my intake paperwork. And I have an email documenting to parents, here is what I propose. And they say, great. And then there's verbal consent. And so I don't understand. And here's what's so strange is it helped. It worked. There's just no evidence at all that there was not consent.
Thank you. Well, so I'm going to make a motion that we refer this case to an informal hearing.
We have a motion. Do we have a second? We do not have a second on the motion. Motion does die. Do we have another proposed motion? Ms. Shreve.
I'll make a motion that we allow Ms. Galvin or ask Ms. Galvin to move forward with a non-disciplinary consent agreement requiring continuing education credits in both the areas of record keeping and informed consent. I would ask, for input on the hours. I know that she's already completed 3 on record keeping. Do we acknowledge those as complete, in this? That would be my motion. I just need to know how many hours. So X amount of hours in informed consent and X amount of hours in record keeping. She's done 3. I guess I would suggest an additional 3 in record keeping and 3 hours in informed consent.
Do you have any comments or feedback to Ms. Shreve's request for hours?
Is there a second before we get discussion?
For purposes of discussion, thank you.
All right, we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Dinar seconds for purposes of discussion.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Further discussion, Mr. Dinar?
So after hearing from Dr. Sadeh right now, I'm actually inclined to dismiss. But that's my view. I seconded the motion for purposes of discussion. So,
okay. Do we have any other discussion?
So to be clear, the motion on the table is for non-disciplinary order for continuing education for a total of 6 hours in record keeping, accepting the 3 hours that she already completed and 3 additional hours in informed consent. Typically, that is done within 6 months. And so this is essentially a counter offer to her. And we would keep the informal hearing set for probably February in the event that this proposal is not accepted.
That would be my proposal. Nice summary. Thank you.
And we are going to need a roll call on this.
Perfect. Ms. Poe, can you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
No.
Dr. Meyer? Dr. Meyer?
No. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Dinar?
I'm going to vote no because I would have dismissed.
Thank you. Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
Mr. Nguyen?
Yes.
We have 3 yeses, 3 noes, 1 abstention. Motion fails.
All right. Do we want to have further discussion? I don't know, Mr. Nguyen, how much time do we have with you?
I got to be gone any moment. Can you hear me? Is the audio working?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, I got to be gone any moment. Actually, a few minutes ago. So, but I don't want to rush. This is an important issue. So,
yeah. I'm wondering, Ms. Galvin, if perhaps we should table this matter for a future meeting. My request would be that we have all of the materials before us instead of just at least the more recent materials before us, because right now what we have before us is just the proposed consent agreement. And I think there's a lot of moving pieces, but perhaps we can table this till next meeting when we will have another psychologist member present to also be able to participate in the discussion.
Do we need a vote on that? Or is that?
No, the chair has elected to do that. And given that we're unable to reach a consensus on a motion, it appears that that's the best route to take at this time.
Thank you.
So it'll be for the January meeting?
Yes.
Okay.
Do we need to push back the, wasn't there an informal scheduled already? Do we need to push that back?
It wasn't set yet, Dr. Meyer. It was kind of fluid because of the agenda.
Okay.
So Dr. Sade, we're going to go ahead and table this item until next month. We appreciate you being here with us today. Dr. Nguyen, thank you, or Mr. Nguyen, sorry, thank you for staying as well. And then we're going to go ahead and take a comfort break, a 15-minute comfort break. So if we can all reconvene at 11:30, that would be great.
And Madam Chair, this is Ms. Poe. I'm going to go ahead and real quick give out the next CE code word for anybody that's listening for CE attendance. The next CE code word is Christmas, Christmas. And for those that are in attendance that have not done this before, under the meetings tab of the board's website, there is a link that you will click on that you will put in your information, including the CE code words. And that will get submitted to board staff for your attendance. So thank you.
Just to clarify, this is the second word, right?
Yes, that, is,
that
correct.
Is correct.
Okay, thank you.
And to agenda item number 10. Ms. Michelson, will you please provide a summary of the matter to the board?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will keep my summary as brief as possible for this matter. Dr. Pyburn was issued her psychologist license by the board back in 2004. She currently maintains a private practice. In June of this year, the board received a complaint from Dr. Pyburn's estranged son-in-law, BW, which contained various allegations of unprofessional conduct. It was noted that BW previously worked at Dr. Pyburn's practice in an administrative capacity for a period of time until 2020. In October of this year, Dr. Pyburn's attorney contacted board staff regarding this case and indicated that Dr. Pyburn would be willing to consider entering into a consent agreement with the board as she is nearing retirement and was not intending on renewing her license upon its expiration on December 31st of this year. With the assistance of Ms. Galvin, a proposed consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of Dr. Pyburn's license was drafted and sent for their review and consideration. The consent agreement specifies that the surrender shall be effective on Friday, December 17th of this year, so to allow Dr. Pyburn sufficient time to conduct closure sessions and transfer out all remaining clients. Dr. Pyburn's attorney indicated to staff that this date would be sufficient for Dr. Pyburn to wind down her practice completely. Staff received the signed consent agreement from Dr. Pyburn last week, which is before the board for approval here today as a final disposition in this case. It is a disciplinary action that would be reported to the data bank as well. I do see that Dr. Pyburn and her attorney are present here today and can address the board regarding the proposed settlement offer. I do want to note that the complainant BW was notified of today's meeting, but I do not see that he is here present today. So that concludes my summary, but please let me know if there are any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Michelson? Dr. Pyburn and your attorney, I see that you guys are both present. If you could please unmute yourselves and introduce yourselves, and now would be a time to make a statement.
Okay, sorry, it took me a sec to do that. Good morning, board members, board staff. My name is Andrew Brevington. I'm attorney for Dr. Connie Pyburn, who is sitting next to me. I just wanted to say briefly that this disposition was reached by negotiation of the parties and fully takes into account all the issues and concerns. And Dr. Pyburn is here to answer any questions that board members might have.
Thank you. Dr. Pyburn, could you please introduce yourself just for the record?
Connie Pyburn.
Thank you. Board members, do you have any questions for Dr. Pyburn? All right, hearing none, do we have any discussion? We're a quiet group today.
I'll make a motion to accept the proposed consent agreement for surrender of the license.
Second. In a second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor? Actually, do we need a roll call for this, Ms. Galvin? I thought so. Ms. Poe, can you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Dr. Catarino?
Yes.
Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
Motion, vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Pyburn, for being here today, as well as Mr. Brevington. We appreciate your guys' time and patience.
And we appreciate you all. Thank you very much.
We can go to agenda item number 11, Madam Chair, if you would like.
Thank you. Yes, let's please move to agenda item number 11. Ms. Michelson, would you please provide a summary of this matter to the board?
Yes, Madam Chair. Last month, board staff received an email from an anonymous individual, which indicated in part, quote, I have recently been made aware that Lori Wetters, PhD, is practicing in advertising as an industrial organizational psychologist without a license or any psychology degrees and has been for some time. Based on her website, she presents that she is qualified to practice IO psychology and offers business contracts in this capacity. She specializes in diagnosing the human behaviors that are creating complexity in our current business environments. She also offers individual coaching and assessments as a service that she provides on her website. She appears to be primarily self-employed, and her LinkedIn profile lists her degrees as a bachelor's in education and a PhD in HR management. In reviewing her website for her business, which is called Purposeful Leadership Consulting, and also reviewing her LinkedIn profile, I noted that while it does not appear that Dr. Wetters is claiming to practice clinical psychology, she does indicate that she is a, quote, industrial/organizational psychologist, end quote. The services listed on the website include executive coaching and individual assessments. Some of the individual assessments listed on the website under the services were of concern to staff, but did not include any additional information. These ones of concern were behavioral assessments and cognitive assessment in particular. Board staff discussed this information with Ms. Galvin, and it was determined that this information would be presented to the board for their review to determine if a complaint should be opened to investigate these concerns, if there appears to be a possible title violation under ARS 32-2084 regarding unlicensed practice of psychology or the use of the psychologist designation. I do want to note that this matter is only for the board today to determine if the information before you warrants opening a complaint for further investigation. If a complaint was opened, it would follow the typical complaint adjudication process for a title violator case. Dr. Wetters would be requested to submit a response to the complaint, and it would be reviewed by the CSC at a later date if a complaint was opened. This concludes my summary, but please let me know if there are any questions.
Are there any questions for Ms. Michelson? Dr. Catarino?
Yes, on the website, that said, and APA accepts my ability to practice or something like that. I don't know if that's a misstatement or is that another different kind of charge? Because I don't think APA does accept that, because they have a whole list of educational requirements for IO according to Division 14. So is that some other like misrepresentation there that APA accepts their qualifications?
If you decide to open a complaint, then that's something that the staff could look into.
I see. So right now we're just asking for opening a complaint.
Whether to open a complaint, correct.
Now, I have one other question. And this, another time we had a situation when, and the case was dismissed. They said, well, they're not a licensed person, so they're not, don't fall under our purview. So it was let go. So I don't understand if this is different or.
The question here would be, she is not licensed. So we're looking at whether she is, her behavior, her advertisements, holding herself out as a psychologist, does that constitute a violation of the Practice Act?
That was the same situation in the other case.
Dr. Catarino, excuse me, Ms. Galvin, sorry. It's just, okay. If you open a case, then we look at that. And if we find that she is misrepresenting herself, or just if there has been in the past, then we send them potentially a notice. You can't do that.
Okay. So the question right now is whether or not we open.
So I'll make a motion that I open. I'll make a motion we open a case.
I second that.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries.
Madam Chair, we don't believe that the applicant listed in item 18 is present, but can we just do a check to see if perhaps it's one of the unidentified tiles? If he's here, we'd like to move to that agenda item for his benefit, but I'm not sure he's here.
I don't know if he needs to be here.
Correct. Yes, just for purposes of, you know, giving him the courtesy of hearing his agenda item.
Dr. Simmons, are you on the call? He is not.
Kathy, folks asked if I would just briefly review this then.
Yes. So we are going to move to agenda item number 18. Dr. Catarino, you are the lead for this application matter. Please summarize it for the board.
So for some reason, I don't know why this person was not included in the applicant review committee that met earlier this week. And typically there, we look at is the program, did this person complete a doctoral level program? Was the program accredited? And he went to Alliant and it was accredited. He completed an internship at the ASU Counseling Center with over 2,000 hours. And so usually, and we have the references and the query form. So usually at this point, we would have said in the applicant review committee that we would agree for them to be considered a temporary licensee, because the parts that we look for are there, the education and the training and the other paperwork. So I think we would have agreed that he can sit for temporary license and take the EPPP.
Perfect. Is that a motion?
Yes. That we accept Dr. Jeffrey Simmons. We allow him to sit for the EPPP and award him temporary licensure.
Seconded.
No, second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? All right. Can we do that vote one more time? Because I did not get enough audible votes for a quorum. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Are we good to move to agenda item number 12?
Yes, Madam Chair. You can address the rest of the items in any order that you would like.
Thank you. I appreciate all of your help in making sure we were addressing them with quorum. All right, discussion. Item number 12, agenda item. I'm the lead on this matter. On the matter previously reviewed by the Committee on Behavior Analysts, so I will provide a summary to the board. Ms. Jones was a behavior analyst that we had identified as providing supervision to a BCBA candidate for licensure here in Arizona. We did meet with both the individual BCBA that had received supervision from Ms. Jones, as well as another supervisor that was involved in the contract. And it was determined that The licensee was able to acquire additional supervision hours. So the student has become licensed. We did meet with the supervisor that was the signee on the contract and determined that that supervisor did not provide any supervision outside of licensure. However, Ms. Jones, in review of the case, it appears that Ms. Jones did provide supervision from out of state. She is unlicensed to an individual that was providing services to school students here in Arizona, school-age students here in Arizona. Upon asking for an explanation of the relationship, Ms. Jones provided the board a written letter saying that she has never provided supervision in Arizona or to anyone in Arizona. However, we had documentation and attestation from the student and the Ms. Jones's supervisor that yes, supervision did in fact occur. So the committee was concerned that the response, the original response was dismissive, basically just said, nope, I've never, you know, I don't know why you're contacting me. I've never provided this service. Our evidence suggests otherwise. And so the committee is bringing forth a proposal to go ahead and proceed with opening a complaint against Ms. Kristen Jones so that we can further review the matter.
So is that a motion?
Yes.
Then I will second that motion.
So we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. We will move to agenda item number 13. This matter is on the agenda as by statute, the board shall annually elect from its members individuals to serve as chair, vice chair, and secretary. Ms. Pakanon, will you please provide a report on the interest you have received thus far and from the members who are willing to serve as an officer?
Yes, Madam Chair. So I issued my usual call for self-nominations or nominations of one another for candidacy for the three offices that by statute this board is required to elect members to on an annual basis. Thus far, I received an indication from Dr. Davis Wilson that she would be willing to serve as chair, vice chair if needed. Actually, Dr. Davis Wilson, I think you said any office more accurately. So you presumably then would accept a nomination for secretary. And then Dr. Davey indicated that he would be happy to continue serving in the capacity of the vice chair. I did not receive any other self-nominations or nominations as part of this process. So the board may wish to consider nominations from the floor for any of these positions. And I think what we've historically done is we have elected to the position of chair, followed by vice chair, and concluded with secretary.
Thank you. So we'll proceed with the election of board chair. Do we have any nominations or self-nominations?
I'd nominate Dr. Davey. As typically in the vice, as the vice has moved up, I mean, it's from experience, that's historically what we've done all the years in the sense of they've had an opportunity to kind of get a feel for it. And nothing, Dr. Davis Wilson, you've done nothing but an incredible job, hands down, incredible job. In an interest to rotate and give opportunity, I would nominate Dr. Davies.
I appreciate that, Ms. Shrews, but I just, the bandwidth that I have with some other obligations going on and just keeping up, I don't think I could also take on the chairship at this time. And so I appreciate that. And that's why I offered to remain kind of as a vice chair, as, you know, stay abreast of everything that's going on and can fill in. But I just cannot take that on, given some other things that are going on.
And who's secretary right now? Dr. Meyer, isn't that correct? Then I nominate Dr. Myers to be chair.
Can I say ditto to what Dr. Davey said?
You could say ditto. I'm just trying to provide opportunity here.
I'm working to try to get out of some extra responsibilities this coming year. And if I'm successful, I'd be willing to push this to the following year, but I'm
very. It's on the record. That is on the record, Dr. Meyer.
Anything else? I said will. What? Oh, yeah.
Shall? I heard shall.
Possibility? Consideration?
We most definitely, Ms. Shreve, have a plan. I think I'm going to be mandated to be on vacation a couple of meetings this year. So we're just going to throw people in. Ms. Shreve, would you like the opportunity to be back as chair?
No, I just want to make sure that there's, you know, that's part of the whole growth thing. That's what I did. Went up through it. You learn, you know, give people an opportunity. And so I just wanted to make sure, because sometimes, you know, we all want to be nice. And I mean, you've done a great job, but I don't know if Mr. Dinar's wants to be on the board, have an opportunity to do that. Some people are shy.
I'll say the same thing that Dr. Davey and Dr. Meyer said.
Right. So you can't say I'm not trying. Dr. Catarino, you know, I mean, it's like, all right, then I nominate Dr. Davis Wilson. But anyway, 5 times out, I'm good.
I am happy to help the board however necessary. And I do have the means and time to help. So I would accept a nomination. But like Ms. Shreve, I agree that this is a great opportunity, and would strongly encourage folks to consider through their 10-year, their 5 years term, to consider taking an office position and moving up as we were all able to do. And I will maybe not be so nice next year. Maybe I'll be busy. So be ready, guys. Be ready. All right.
You've done a great job. So thanks. So I nominated, there has to be a second, right? Is that true? Yes.
Yes, it does.
I'll second it.
All right. We have a nomination and a second. All in favor. Do I vote on this? Do I not vote? We have to have a quorum, don't we?
You may.
I have to vote, right?
You have a quorum, but you can abstain, but you can also vote for yourself.
Right, you put confidence in yourself.
Yeah, we need a leader with confidence.
I was just making sure procedurally I wasn't being crazy. All right. All in favor, please indicate so by saying yes. Yes. Or yeah.
Aye.
Aye. That's the one. any opposed? The motion carries. The board has elected myself, Dr. Davis Wilson, to position a board chair for 2022. We will now proceed to election of board vice chair. Do we have any additional nominations or self-nominations? I believe we have Dr. Davey. Anybody else interested in trying vice chair?
If anyone wants to be nominated, make eye contact with me.
Blink twice. Blink twice if you want to.
All the cameras go off. All right.
Dr. Davies would be great.
Yeah. He hasn't screwed it up thus far, right?
No, he's great.
I literally just carry around Dr. Davis Wilson's suitcase and bags and files for her to make sure she gets safely. I'm really just her bodyguard.
All right. So we do have a nomination for Dr. Davey. Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion carries. And now it gets real interesting. We need a secretary. So we will now move to nominations for secretary. Do we have any self-nominations or nominations for secretary, Ms. Shreve?
I'll nominate Dr. Catarino.
I'll decline. I don't really have the time. I'm barely making the time for this.
I'm not going to take this personal.
And that's a good point, Ms. Shreve, and perhaps board staff. Can you go over the time? I mean, I think Dr. Davey's aware of kind of the time commitment for vice chair because he was already there. The chair does have more of a time commitment because there's pre-meeting and meeting prep and things like that. So that's understandable. But right now, with everything being electronic and signing and stuff, can you go over the responsibilities of the secretary? Perhaps that will help.
Yes, Madam Chair. So We obviously have our board meeting minutes professionally prepared to best ensure that, you know, the content is professionally captured. So that is something that is outsourced. Board staff is responsible for ensuring that the minutes are properly maintained, archived, and signed. And so really the responsibility of the secretary would be limited to signing whatever copies of all previously approved minutes, board approved minutes, come to the secretary. And also if there is anything that, you know, presents as an anomaly or a possible error in the process of reviewing previously approved minutes, calling that to the staff's attention to remedy. So the time commitment is pretty minimal.
I submitted my signature and that was pretty much it, so.
Maybe we should all rethink who wants to be secretary.
So if nobody else wants to do it, then I take all the minutes, and because I've been secretary of other groups. So if nobody else can do it, then I can do that.
Yeah, and this one is different because they do have a minutes administrator. And so it really is, and we do all review and vote on the minutes. So it really is just the signature after all of the other processes have been done. And because we're electronic right now, everything is done through electronic signature. So I and Dr. Meyer, you were secretary this year. So maybe you know different. When I was secretary, it was manageable and minimal. And that was when we had to actually physically go in and sign everything. So I would say it was very simplified. So I would imagine that it's even less work now.
Yeah, the board staff are amazing and take care of everything.
Feel better about it, Dr. Catarino?
Yes. Yeah, I've been in other things where I'm writing all these minutes all the time.
Oh, no, so. Yeah. All right, so I nominate Dr. Catarino. Are you in, Dr. Catarino?
Okay.
Second.
Thank you for the nomination.
Yeah, we have a nomination, and Mr. Dinar has seconded it. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
I'm abstaining.
Any opposed? It was a very, very valiant effort, Dr. Catarino, but you are the new board secretary, so thank you.
Thank you.
I can't believe she bought that.
You can't believe I what? I'm sorry.
Nice.
You
bought
our explanation of how little this is. You're going to be exhausted.
Oh, no! Again, I believed you. I thought we had to keep to the highest ethical standards here.
Not when it comes to finding officers.
Great. Okay.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, congratulations to the
board. Thank you all.
Woohoo!
Thank you. Perhaps Ms. Pakanon, perhaps board staff could make a note that maybe come July, August again, we kind of start having some discussions around these roles, just to remind those that that are hesitant as to what kind of the workload looks like, but also if someone is interested. I personally find that come November, December, that's when everybody, like, all the workload drops and it's like, trying to frantically get through things. So that's probably the hardest time to ask. But maybe if we're having this conversation a little bit earlier, we can encourage some board members to consider making some time for just the experience itself. So I think that would be helpful.
Yes, Madam Chair. So what I'm hearing you say is that maybe a job description might be useful.
That I think would be very useful, but then also I think the reminders closer to time so that people can consider it when they're looking at their schedules. I don't know. I mean, I'm a university professor, so I'm sure those of us that are, we plan everything by semesters. And so, like, spring was planned by end of July. And so, you know, and then, you know, we will have fall planned before the end of April. And so having a little bit of that kind of reminder of, hey, we'll be having these nominations again, might be helpful in kind of helping board members pre-plan their schedule.
Yes.
Thank you. I have a question.
Yes, Dr. Katerina.
How do we go about replacing Dr. Gill? Is there some movement to do that?
So I think that we can add that to a future agenda item. I did address it earlier in the meeting that board staff is working on it. But that's, I think, all we can, that's all the update we have right now. This is a very, very sudden change. It's not, we have not had a ton of planning. It was unexpected by all parties. And so I think that it's something that we will make sure is on the future agenda so that board staff can provide us those updates.
Thank you.
Absolutely. All right. We will now move to agenda item number.
Aren't we down two psychologists right now?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, we are.
Better start recruiting, Dr. Meyer. Dr. Katerina.
What's that?
Better start recruiting some people.
Yeah.
All right. We are now going to move to agenda item 15. Ms. Pakanon, will you please provide a summary of this matter to the board?
Yes, Madam Chair. And in fact, this is going to be another show and tell exercise. So, consistent with the process that the Rules Committee and then the board has followed over the past several months in reviewing the administrative rules and identifying rule revisions that you would like to have drafted, the Committee on Behavior Analysts has completed the same exercise. So really, starting in January of 2021, they have done at least two very thorough and thoughtful reviews of the administrative rules. They've come up with a few recommendations for revisions, not nearly as many as the psychologist rules, but I thought it would be useful to go through this draft. And then I invite our two behavior analyst members and CBA members to chime in and comment to augment or potentially correct anything that I state relative to these proposed revisions. So with that, I don't recall any changes in the definitions rule. The first change or set of changes to R426-402 are a mirror image or an exact are exact to the same recommendations that the board has approved previously for fees and charges. So nothing that is a departure here that you haven't already discussed and approved. But if you have any questions, I can take those. Okay, hearing none. Similar to a change that the board approved, specific to the rule application for initial licensure. In this case, the BA rule is R426-403. We don't really need, staff doesn't feel we need to specify that the photograph accompanying the application be of passport quality. It actually creates more confusion than the intent, than its intent to clarify. So that is a familiar change to you. And then the next changes come to the rule. Scroll too fast. Supervised experience requirement at 404.2. There was some considerable discussion about this, as I recall. And there was a request made that effective supervision, the subsection that addresses effective supervision, that both synchronous and asynchronous observation is acceptable. And specifically that that came from out of a discussion, I think very early on with my time with the CBA, where the former chair had indicated or commented that the ability to provide asynchronous observation is important in rural Arizona in particular, where internet bandwidth may be limited, and also just to provide some more, I guess, greater access to this type of supervision. So I don't know if our CBA members want to provide any other insights or perspective here. Okay, it doesn't sound like it. So then there was some discussion, some acknowledgement about how the BACB will be reallocating the content within the required minimum number of classroom hours of graduate level instruction. And given that this rule is very precise and very specific, the concern is that if we continue to maintain that approach and specify in the rule what the requirements are to be for the core content for the program, whenever that changes, the rule will need to change. And so the proposal instead was to defer to the verified course sequence rather than provide the specificity in the rule language. Dr. Davis-Wilson and Dr. Davey may have some additional comments to that as well.
Yeah, Ms. Peckman, my only concern is I don't mind having the prescribed minimum hours. The mm-hmm. problem with how they've kind of moved around these hours is that it changes. And so when we get specific all the way down to like the syllabus hours, one, it's very difficult for us to know, you know, there's well over 1,000 different programs. And so for us to look at the transcripts and try to figure out how these hours are allocated, it's very difficult. And two, if any of it changes slightly, it's so prescribed. So for example, if, you know, 5 hours moves from measurement and data analysis to experimental design, we would have to write a whole new rule for that, even though it doesn't really, it's still part of the research methods and behavior analysis. And so we're proposing to keep the minimum hours, but to do away from having it so prescribed by each course that it makes the review difficult and may stunt any applicants coming through that take programs in which these things have changed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, to try to illustrate this point, ethical and professional conduct, currently 45 hours, a minimum of 45 hours is required. If even 2 hours were to shift in, you know, from this, the distribution were to shift from this content area to, you know, the next one, concepts and principles of BA, that small change is a substantial change where qualification for licensure is concerned. So just something as simple as the hours are maintained, but the distribution changes could be highly problematic for purposes of qualifying. So so the CBA is looking for a solution where there's ongoing recognition of and benchmarking to the verified course sequence. So I hope this makes sense to everyone.
So I got a question. So is there not a standard, a recognized national standard of what you need to receive this, you know, to be a behavior analyst? I mean, why do we need to have specific hours? Because like we all, I mean, anyone, I've teached in university too. I mean, things change, right? And so does it make sense to do that? Or does it make sense to say they have to meet certain standard or qualification?
And our proposal would be that we remove how it's prescribed like this, and then the language, we've added it to a couple of places, would reference the national standard. So one of the things that, and we don't see a problem with it, the total classroom hours, there is a national standard on that. I think having the total hours still in the rule is fine to give that safeguard should at any point, which I don't see it happening, should at any point our standards take a step back and they say, oh, never mind, we actually think that you can do this in two college courses instead of a full master's degree. So I'm fine with like the total, but then where it exactly to your point, we should be able to reference the national, the verified course sequence, as far as whether or not the program was approved, and assume that by it being an approved program, our rule will have been met versus prescribing it separate for our rule.
So what we were just seeing was highlighted. There was no edit in there. Is it formatted where it's deleted and then you have the new language in there?
Madam Chair, yes. I realized that I was working from the Google Doc format of this material, which doesn't present all the functionality that you're wanting to see. So I just pulled up the Word document itself, which is a much better representation of the change. So you can see the comment on the right that the CDA's recommendation.
No, it's a blank screen.
It's a blank screen for us.
Yeah, it's not showing.
Yeah, and that, I guess that's why I brought it up, is that there. I was like, why is it highlighted? Not, I mean, if we didn't have any proposed language.
Here we go. Sorry about that.
This is the other issues. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
So it's this comment. We haven't done a whole lot in the form of actual wordsmithing. We're going to provide this to our rule writer and let her tackle this. But what you needed to see, which the Google Doc version didn't present, is this comment here.
Okay.
So this is a better format to work from. So I apologize. I should have pulled this one up in the first place.
Oh, we're good. That answers all my questions. I mean, that's
Yeah, and just for the board's understanding, you know, to highlight this even more, come January 1st of 2022, the actual coursework requirements are jumping from 270 to 315. And so the BACB and its work through the course content has really gone through evolution over the course of just the years we've been on this board. I mean, there was some discussion about intensive practicum early on, which we excluded from licensure path because it was only 750 hours of supervised work, and we wanted to force towards the 15. The BACB has since gotten rid of the intensive practicum option. And so, you know, as the field has grown, so has the requirements and the rigor to get through that, much like where you all psychologists sit today. We're probably, you know, at some point we'll be close to where psychologists are in terms of classroom hours and supervised work, but it's just an iterative process as the field grows. So yeah, I think that, you know, it's the up to 270 classroom hours, knowing that the next round of those that start towards their national certification and then coming forth for licensure, you know, several years after that, we'll have 315 hours, in which, you know, they go in actually different categories starting in the coming years. They're pumped into ethics code and code enforcement systems and professionalism, philosophical underpinnings, which are concepts and principles, measurement, data, display, interpretation, and then purposeful supervision and management's now 30 hours. Things that aren't even in there as titles are now going to be forward starting January 1. So, you know, I think we're trying to do a very general statement here to make sure that as things increase, we're covered.
Can I have a question?
Dr. Katerina.
So could it be listed maybe like the psychology one, where if you graduated from an accredited program, then go no further. But if it's not an accredited program, then you have to have 1 3 credit course in ethics and professional conduct, 1 3 credit semester course in the first one, and another, the second one, 1 3 credit semester course in that, rather than the actual hours. You have to, is that how it's written, by hours, like 45 hours? And
yeah, so Dr. Katerina, sorry, go ahead, Dr.
Oh, you go ahead. Sorry, you can explain.
We're essentially proposing that. The language is a little bit different because we don't have APA accreditation. Instead, we have ABAI verified course sequence. And so that is what we're suggesting, is that rather than listing out all of the hours, that we say, hey, if you've done it through a verified course sequence, then you would be eligible. The same, and it again, verbiage is different, but it intends to do the same thing as the APA accreditation. The only difference is that there's an alternative pathway for psychologists if it's not APA accredited. Mm-hmm. We don't have that because you can't become nationally certified without going through that verified course sequence. So we don't need that alternative pathway, but it'll essentially, the essence of what we're doing is exactly what you're proposing.
And then did you need the number 3, where I think the measurement, do you think it's good to break that down or just have 45 for the total course?
We're going to take
measurement
out
that, and data analysis.
We're going to take out all of the section that's highlighted in red.
Okay.
To take all of that and replace it with the language that we would just be following that of the verified course sequence.
Okay. Thank you.
So are you increasing beyond the 270 hours if that's, you said the standards are going up?
So Dr. Meyer, at this point, we're actually recommending not for right now. Yes, the standards are going to go up and they're going to continue to go up. But the challenge is that there isn't programs for bridge coursework. So if somebody is in California and they come to move to Arizona, they would be ineligible for licensure. So we want to keep the minimum. That 270 hours has been the same number since, oh gosh, I didn't do 270, but shortly after I did my coursework. So it's been quite some time. And we have in there the section A that catches everybody before January 1st of 2015. But we would either have to move that date to January 1st of 2022 or change the 270. We can't leave both. And so our proposal is, rather than continuing to move that date, that we would just keep the minimum, knowing that that would capture everybody. But we are aware that their hours are going to continue to increase.
Okay. And really the safety net here is the BACB will not certify someone that's not hitting the requirements during the proper time frame. So if you apply starting after the 1st of January, then you're going to be held at that 315. So you're not going to get through their system with 270 if you were not matriculated and already in programs. So we have that. And I think also it goes back to the fact that some of this is in statute versus rule, where we probably have to clean that up at a later date, because you'll see the reference there to R-426 for 404.1, where it talks about the graduate hours. And so at some point we'll have to probably get those things aligned.
Excellent. Are we ready for the next one then?
Yes. Mr. Dinar was going to say something. I want to make sure that his question or concern was addressed.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify for the record what ABAI stands for, and I figured it out. It was Behavior Analyst International Association. So, yeah.
Yes. Thank you. Perfect. Thank you.
I appreciate that. I didn't realize that either. Thanks.
Just for the clarification, that's the group that essentially verifies the course sequences at the universities. So there's arm's distance between the certifying body and the body that is essentially reviewing and approving the coursework to get through into the certification.
Okay, very good. So on the earlier version, I had alluded, another change had alluded me, but in this version, now I remember that we will need to put the fingerprint card requirement into both the rules for application for licensure and also for licensure renewal. So that is something that, was put into effect with the Senate Bill 1253 that passed earlier in the 2021 session and is technically in effect, even though we're still waiting for the FBI approval to be an agency that can receive fingerprint clearance card information. But the rule needs to reflect that as a requirement in both initial licensure and renewal. So I'll make sure our rule writer addresses that. And then we asked just to remove what is sort of a redundancy in the rule. We cite a sworn affidavit that the applicant has not practiced as a BA in Arizona when renewing the license since the license expired. And I think this is the reinstatement. No, it's still the renewal rule. So we do ask this, and it's a required declaration on the application. So having it in rule seems a little bit redundant. So moving on, the next change is under CE. The committee would like to award continuing education credit for attending a board meeting, not only a board meeting, but also a meeting of the Committee on Behavior Analysts.
Ms. Packman, can I just go back for 1 second before we get into that? Sure. I want to clarify my statement on the education requirement in our rules, right? I mean, I think that the one section that I was referencing, that 24.26.401, the most current version for 7.4.2020 is already actually cleaned up, correct? For 26.404.01 education requirements. They were effective in 2020. Yeah, right there. Okay, so I just wanted to point that out for what we were just talking about in terms of that list. We've already cleaned up this section to read, it's certified by them before that date that Dr. Davis-Wilson was referencing. And then the fact that they need to be to be licensed, they have to come from that accredited institution of higher ed and that they're in a program that meets the requirements specified by. So we've already cleaned up that section. We're just bringing in line the edits that you're seeing to be in line with this documentation as well. So I just wanted to clarify my statement because I believe I misspoke when I said we were going to need to do that. In fact, we'd already done that last round.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, Ms. Beckham.
That is fine. So with respect to continuing education credit, the CBA meetings have increasingly expanded the content as it relates to regulation, ethical practice, and so forth. Once upon a time, the CBA meetings were primarily, or even perhaps exclusively, they existed for purposes of reviewing qualifications for licensure and did not include any sort of complaint reviews or regulatory policy issues. Now that the committee meetings are more encompassing of those kinds of topics and in many ways emulate, albeit on a smaller scale, but emulate the topics that the board meetings encompass, the CBA has discussed awarding credit for CE credit for attendance at CBA meetings. So questions or comments to that?
And we have a complimentary agenda item to this later, correct?
We do. And I think that what the goal of this is as well is to encourage behavior analysts to attend these meetings. They are highly informative. And so with the incentivizing attendance through awarding CE credit, we might see many more behavior analysts attending these meetings. Okay, then I'll move on. I don't know that we had any other edits. We do have one final change or addition to discuss, which is on a separate document. So any questions or comments to what we just reviewed? Okay, then I think we're ready to move on to the next item, and bear with me while I pull that up. I'm going to want to download that one as well.
I just need to walk away from my camera for 1 second, sorry.
Okay, very good. So let me download this to a Word document, and then I'll share my screen. Here we go. Okay, can everyone see the Word document now? Application for initial licensure. Okay, I just provided this content here just for purposes of comparison. So this is the existing rule that prescribes the, besides universal recognition, the only pathway for application for initial license. And so Dr. Davis Wilson was kind enough to work with me to conceive of what a rule might look like. It would have to be a brand new rule that would be introduced in the next promulgation. It may or may not be numbered the way that I represented here at 403.01, but it would be an application for licensure by, I'm sorry, not endorsement, sometimes old habits die hard. It would be by reciprocity. So the board does have a statute that authorizes or grants the board authority to establish licensure by reciprocity as an application option. We've just never had a rule that effectively achieved that. So this rule potentially achieves just that. So it would be recognition of educational qualifications, training, and so forth that existed at the time that person was initially licensed by another jurisdiction. And this, the committee felt very strongly that this pathway to apply by reciprocity is only open to behavior analysts who were licensed in any jurisdiction. So there are now a shrinking number of jurisdictions that still do not license behavior analysts, but the committee made a policy decision to recommend that if a behavior analyst has never before been licensed by any other U.S. jurisdiction, reciprocity is not an option. So maybe I'll stop there and allow for any questions or comments to that. And the CBA members may want to chime in as well.
I mean, I'll just add, you know, one of our reasons for this was with universal recognition, you know, we're always asked, do we have licensure by reciprocity? And they're different. But yes, if you're moving in from out of state and you're already previously licensed in another state for a year in good standing, you can come get licensed here anyway. So I think that's what kind of led us going this direction. We still feel strongly about the role of licensure and protecting the public. So we wouldn't want to open this up to the states that don't have licensure because they would be coming potentially certified coming into, you know, a regulatory role they're not used to being a part of. But I mean, this is more just to kind of align with some of the universal recognition direction anyway. The intent of
issue. Mm-hmm. Is this similar to the language we have in the psychology end side of it? Of universal recognition?
Madam Chair, if I understand your question correctly, so we do have, we don't call them reciprocity pathways for psychologists. We have opportunities to apply for licensure by waiver, by credential. So in those are, I think, very similar to reciprocity. Okay. So I think the short answer is yes.
Okay, thanks.
You are welcome. And so what reciprocity achieves too, which is a departure from universal recognition, it allows for the evaluation, true evaluation of qualifications for licensure, the education and the training and so forth. But the way that this rule is proposed, it's very, very similar to the application for initial licensure that I had on the first page. But what it does instead is that it recognizes the requirements that were specified by this BACB at the time that person was initially certified. As we've been acknowledging, the goalposts move. And so we don't, in the process, we don't want to preclude somebody from coming to Arizona if they met the requirements that existed at the time they completed their education and training. And since that time, they have become very highly skilled and that their professional experience is vast. So this is hopefully a pathway to bring those experienced practitioners to our state and not force them to simply conform to the universal recognition path. So this language envisions, again, meeting the requirements specified by the BACB at the time of initial certification, meeting the requirements specified by the BACB at the time of initial certification where education is concerned. So we're just recognizing, you know, all of that past, if you will. And we did decide that we would not impose a work history requirement in the process. Any questions, or would the BA members like to embellish anything that I just explained?
No, you nailed it.
Okay, excellent. So then there are a couple of other changes that will need to be executed as part of this establishing the reciprocity pathway. We would need to delete subsection A of the rule for education requirements. So Dr. Davey, you cited that one, I think, a little earlier, but we would eliminate subsection A. And then finally, for the supervised experience requirement, we would delete subsection A2. So all of these changes essentially allow us to be more fluid as it relates to the past, and also more fluid as it relates to the future. So what I see happening is that we have enough content for both, all four articles, the three that are specific to psychologist regulation, and then now this one. I'd like to bring all this content to our rule writer and have her get started. This, of course, is a process, and the draft will come to you at least one more time. If I had to guess, it will come to you more than once, potentially for clarification, for further discussion, to consider issues that we didn't consider or that weren't raised in the process of this extensive review that we've gone through over the past year. So this is only the very beginning of the process. So our rule writer is very efficient. She's quite busy right now, but she assured me that beginning this month, she can start setting aside time to work with us. So you may see some drafts. I'm not sure as early as the January meeting, but quite likely we'll have some drafts to look at in February. Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peckman.
My pleasure.
Good times.
We will go ahead.
I just wanted to say good work, everyone. I know this is hard work, and I appreciate the time and effort that our staff put into it.
And Madam Chair and members of the board, this is Ms. Poe. I'm going to go ahead and give out the next CE code word. The next CE code word is Kwanzaa. Kwanzaa. Thank you.
Excellent. All right. We will now move to agenda item number 16. Ms. Packnon, will you please provide a summary of this matter to the board?
Yes, certainly, Madam Chair. Now I'm speculating about what code word number 4 is. I see maybe a trend, so I'm curious to see if I'm right or I'm wrong. Dr. Davey did issue a little bit of a spoiler alert that we would be having a related discussion when we were looking at the continuing education rule for behavior analysts. So the BACB has recently made some decisions that incentivizes regulatory boards to become ACE providers, authorized continuing education providers, for purposes of awarding credit, CEU credit, to certificates so that they can use that credit toward maintaining their certification. At least one regulatory board has already applied to the BACB and achieved that ACE provider status. And there's definite interest on the part of the CBA. They've made a recommendation to this board that we proceed also with submitting an application. In doing so, we need to designate a behavior analyst to serve as the the ACE coordinator. Thank you. Yeah. So we would need to obtain board approval to submit the application in the first place, and also to approve a behavior analyst, a member of the CBA, possibly a member of this board as a behavior analyst to serve in that capacity. So if there are any questions, I'm happy to address them. Dr. Davey has been really instrumental in being a champion of this development. So perhaps Dr. Davey has comments to offer.
I mean, the comments are very similar to what you offered before. It's that we want to encourage behavior analysts, whether they're in school, whether they're getting ready to apply for licensure, or whether they're already licensed, to engage and listen to the CBA meetings, where they can hear about the things that are impacting their practice inside the state. The psychologists have already had that mechanism in place through attending the full board. The full board does not make a lot of sense to be the place where we award the credits, as most of the items will not necessarily pertain to behavior analytic practice or ethics within behavior analytic practice. However, the CBA meetings do allow for that. And so to be able to provide ethics credits for attendance and being active in for the state licensing board just as I believe to be a win-win. It's going to help bring about the next generation of behavior analysts that will hopefully fill seats on the CBA and ultimately on this board by engaging them and getting them versed in all things related to management and operations of these boards. I mean, Dr. Davis Wilson and I were not afforded that. We were on the kind of the beginning of making sure that we had temporary ad hoc you guys essentially granted us the ability to provide feedback to the psychology board before there was a committee. Now we have a committee, and the committee now has the ability to provide information to inform this board. And so we're just at that crossroads where this makes a lot of sense. We have multiple people on the CBA that are willing to step forward. Any of them will be wonderful ACE coordinators. We're still sorting through who that might be. But at this point, we just want the board to provide the go-ahead to complete the application, let the CBA identify who's going to be the coordinator within the parameters of any rules or responsibilities for that person, and get that application submitted so that we can begin providing credit in 2022.
Ms. Pacnon, I have a question then, because I was ready to make a motion to go ahead and nominate an ACE provider or an ACE coordinator. Could
as
we,
as long as her initials are PR, you're good to go.
Nope. It will start with a Brian, end with a Davey. What I would like to request, though, just so that we could work through it, perhaps the board would be in support of the committee taking that vote and the committee going ahead and moving forward. Ultimately, and Ms. Galvin, you can correct me if we have to do it different, but can we as a board make a motion to designate that task back to the committee, and then that way they can vote? And because one of the things very similar to Ms. Shreve's points of cross-training others, two of the committee members are already ACE coordinators for other entities. And so our intention would be to help support an ACE coordinator for the committee without it being one of us, but we would be able to support and train. I've actually been an ACE coordinator for 10 years now. So I've been through all of the evolutions of ACE coordination through the BACB for many years. So my ask, Ms. Galvin, is can we vote today to just, or can we have a consensus to delegate it back to the committee and let the committee vote without having to come back and forth?
Yes, you may.
Okay. Then I move that, we allow the Committee on Behavior Analysts to go ahead and take a vote on who they would like to use as the ACE coordinator.
And to select that individual.
And to select that individual.
Second.
And would we also just amend that, Dr. James Wilson, to say that the board, in accepting this recommendation to allow this allow credit for behavior analysts via the CBA, will also be like to get that out there as well, because we want that approved as well.
Yes, and I will amend my motion to include the board's blessing to go ahead and allow for the ACE provider process to take place.
Second as well.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Thank you very much. We will now move to agenda item number 17. Ms. Pakanon, can you please provide us a summary of this matter?
Yes, Madam Chair. I don't have a substantial update for this board. Just by way of reminder, you last indicated that you wanted the January agenda to include an item to revisit the issue of whether to resume in-person meetings, when, at what frequency, and so forth. I am hearing increasingly that other boards are exploring and implementing with some success some hybrid meeting types of arrangements. That's of course predicated on some on technology, and there are a number of efforts underway to improve the technology in the building that we occupy, where many of you remember the meetings took place once upon a time. I do think that that is going to be a new factor to consider, that because the technology is failing and increasingly unreliable, until that technology is replaced and upgraded, that's also something that we need to sort of be mindful of. We did meet with, by we, I mean the directors of the 9010 agencies. We met earlier this week, and we had Trista Guzman Glover from the governor's office join the meeting. And the indication that we received was that attention is very quickly turning to the upcoming legislative session. There's a flurry of pre-filed bills already, some of which have to do with the current state of emergency. And so, you know, this is all very early, so we don't know, of course, at this time, the outcome of any of that legislation, but I'll be tracking that and reporting on it as well. Ms. Guzman Glover did not give us any indication about the state of emergency and its duration or any modifications to that. So that is all I have at this time.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Pakanon? Hearing none, can we move to agenda item number 19? Are there any agenda items for future meetings? I think the only one that I want to know, if we could potentially just get updates on filling board seats, I think that would be appreciated. I know that there is some creative minds in the board staff, and so I know that they're working diligently to come up with ideas and CSC coverage and all of the things that come with our current status. So I think an update might help ease everybody's minds along the way.
This is gonna seem weird, but with my suggestion, I'd actually like to go into executive session to receive legal advice around
future agenda items.
Yes.
Okay.
I'll second it.
I know how exciting this is going to be. Yeah.
I mean, now I'm just curious.
I wanted to keep the end of the meeting spicy.
Okay. So we have a motion and a second to go into executive session for the purpose of legal advice. Hearing no further discussion, do we have all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed? Motion carries. All right. Last call for future agenda items. Hearing none. Mr. Diner.
So I realize we are over 4 hours, so I want to thank everyone for making sure that everyone got their continuing education. Yes. My question next agenda as an agenda item is, I was actually surprised to hear that the attendance won't count if the meeting lasts less than 4 hours. So I want to discuss options that, hey, I mean, if the meeting lasts 1 hour or 2 hours, can they still get those 1 or 2 hours as continuing education credits? Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Diner, I think that's a good point. And I think being an ACE coordinator for another organization, I have suspicions as to why it was 4 hours, but that's probably quite historical. And I think reviewing it now, and then I'm guessing there's statute issue or rule language around it, but yes, I think, and especially with us proposing some rule changes, now's a great time to revisit that. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yes, Madam Chair, what I could do, Mr. Diner, is just preemptively put that into the rule draft. And then when you see this document, as I'm predicting in February, then you can definitely have the discussion at that time. And you've had time to sort of contemplate it. And if there's any research that you want me to do relative to, you know, what other boards, where their cutoffs are, do they exist, or do they just do hour for hour credit, I'm happy to take a look at that and bring that back to you to help inform your discussion around it.
Thank you.
It will be on a future agenda then.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful, McFadden, about having that, what other states or other organizations accept.
That would imply we're going to have another short meeting someday.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Hey, we tried. We tried to get below the 4 hours. Like, we even preemptively said, hey, we don't think we're going to go 4 hours.
Good efforts. Yes,
but
I appreciate that.
Then we got so close, we just had to, get to the 4 hours. It would have been awful to end at 3 hours and 45 minutes. All right. Moving.
I would have stalled with like a Christmas rendition of multiple songs celebrating our three code words. And so I'm glad we saved that from the public record.
Oh my.
Yeah, we all are.
All right. We are now on to agenda item number 20, adjournment.
Do we need a code word?
Yeah,
Christian. Sure, I can go ahead and give out the last code word. The last code word is holiday. Holiday.
How'd you do, Heidi?
I was thinking it was going to be Festivus, so I'm wrong.
I did consider that one.
He knew what you were thinking and changed it at the last minute.
How about we'll take either holiday or Festivus as number 4? Either one. A bonus.
Extra credit for Festivus.
Yeah, bonus.
All right. Do we have a motion for adjournment?
I motion.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Thank you, everybody, for another great meeting. This one went quite smoothly. Board staff, thank you for all of your preparation for this. All right. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? The motion carries. Thank you. Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays.
Same to you. Bye-bye.